Dawn. Have to get it on. Greetings, caravanners around the world. This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. I am John B. in the left seat of Ark Midnight, here hovering on the cyber wave. Feels kind of good. Moderation in all things, right? Look, things are really, really heating up. I'm not kidding you either. All over the place. And to that end, we will discuss exactly what's heating up and why it's serious. And which is what we do, of course. Sort of a unnecessary statement of mission. So we'll be joined by Harry S. Dent, founder of Dent Research. Hold tough before you decide, ugh, really? More money? Yeah, you need to hear this pretty bad, actually. And let me tell you why. You know, there are many excellent finance professionals and students, you know, ever the student of economy and markets and so forth. But this stuff affects everybody. When you see what's going on, it should actually, like I say, people kind of want to live their lives, you know, not be bothered with this stuff. Can't. That's over with. You must be aware of this. And what we try to do here is, people are talking about trend this and trend that, and this is up and that's down and over this and what this means. And after a while, your head's just buzzing with it. But I'm sure you will agree that after being with the program for as long as you may have been, you begin to see the picture. You know, the proverbial dots on the white canvas, and you begin to draw a picture of exactly what this means. It's not just blather. Now, if you want blather, you go to mainstream media, and there's plenty of it. You watch the story, and when it's over, you go, what did I just see? But there have been many students and many professionals in the economics and finance realm. But Mr. Dent is the one who has been doing the loudest call for awareness of this deflationary period, not inflation. That's the easy one. That's the it really is. And look, I've sort of gotten into that groove too, because we have pictures of Germany back in the 20s with the wheelbarrows full of cash and trying to buy a tiny bag of groceries with that. But deflation is actually, in some ways, perhaps even more dangerous. And I think it is propitious, if not providential, that we should speak with Harry Dent today. Because behold, right here on CNN Money, sell everything. 2016 will be a cataclysmic year, warns RBS. That's the Royal Bank of Scotland. Sell everything. That's the quote. That harrowing advice from the Royal Bank of Scotland, which has warned of a cataclysmic year ahead for markets, has advised clients to head for the exit. Do not wait. Do not pass go. Andrew Roberts, in a note this week, said, sell everything except high-quality bonds. He said the bank's red flags for 2016, falling oil, volatility in China, shrinking world trade, rising debt, weak corporate loans, and deflation had all been seen in just the first week of trading. He also said, we think investors should be afraid. Those are his words. Morgan Stanley warned this week that oil could touch $20 a barrel. RBS says if it falls below 30, then 16 is on the horizon. The world is in a global recession, Roberts wrote. This terrible cocktail means investors should now be thinking about getting a return of capital, not a return of capital, not a return on capital. Big difference. RBS compares the market mood with that of 2008 before the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the start of the global financial crisis. At least then, emerging markets were there to save the world from complete collapse. China cannot this time around. Is this amazing? Wait till you hear Harry Dent. Just wait till you hear him. China cannot this time around, let alone any other big emerging market. RBS remains deeply skeptical that Chinese authorities can right the ship anytime soon. It warns that without allowing a massive devaluation of its currency, around 20%, China can be of no help. Oh, so we're all inextricably linked. The genius globalists have decided, we'll expand our markets all over the whole world, and we'll set up central banks everywhere, and it'll be a great big party, you idiots. Inbred idiots. Yeah, I'm not kidding you. These people are just, they're nuts. They're so spoiled being awash in money. Their hubris is absolutely over the top and out of control. And it's going to screw them royally, like crank, 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 right against the wall of their own building. It's coming. It really is. I'm not one of these, oh, it's coming, sky's falling. I'm not. To hell with it, the sky's falling. Maybe it'll hit me and maybe it won't. Well, the sky's really big, man. It could hit you. We'll see. But these brilliant people have been warning of this, and it is coming. So make your moves now and prepare. It's really time. We're past times. Like, John B., you've been saying make ready for what's to come. I didn't say it was going to come 2 hours from now. I didn't say it was going to come 2 years from now. I said it's coming, and it is. It's that whole thing about change. I like for it to be, take me staff out there and survey the land. The land is in good order, and the castle's in good order. It's not a big castle, but, you know, it's not too expensive, but it is a castle, and all my goods are at peace, and the family's at peace. Well, now, we're going to switch into Ian Anderson mode with the bed down the women and children, bring me my broadsword and my cross. Okay, that's where we are. RBS believes China suffered a massive outflow of capital in December, perhaps as much as $170 billion, with much of that money going straight into the dollar. See what I mean? Going straight into the dollar. Now, if the dollar staggers, then what? Can China help us? No. A chart showing Chinese outflows in 2015 is, quote, surely now the most important chart in the world. That's what Mr. Roberts said. Mr. Rogers, Mr. Roberts. Did you hear that Bernie Sanders got an endorsement from George Soros' crew? That's the best reason not to go anywhere near that geriatric hippie socialist twit. I've said it. John, you're mean. Yeah, sometimes. I feel like being mean to Bernie. Bernie, actually, I'm glad you're in the race. You know why? Because there's not a snowball's chance in Hades that you can make it. I'm delighted that you're running. Maybe Soros will be of no help to Sanders, much as China will be of no help to the rest of the world once it starts rolling. But there's ever so much more. There really is. Let's see, who else is saying that? Oh, let's see, that's RBS again. This is reassuring, from dailymail.co.uk. Well, the little terror groups are plotting and planning, like the little satanic minions that they are. We are heading toward a European 9/11. Counterterrorism official says terror groups are plotting simultaneous attacks in various countries this year. That's fine. That's fine. Yeah. Government officials, they're very, very concerned about their citizenry, aren't they? Perfectly okay with Sweden becoming the rape capital of the world. Sweden, a civilized, managed country, highly evolved civilization. Germany, same thing. Now they're rape capitals of the world. And who's doing it? Filthy vermin coming from the Middle East. John B. Wells says, drive this vermin by whatever means necessary, with extreme prejudice, back into the sea, and let their fellow Middle Easterners take care of them or not. They are not our problem. Don't you have any compassion for the children? No. They will grow up to become jihadis. They're already training. They're already being sent in with chest packs. You know, the kind with a ripcord on them? They're already training with rifles. There are videos aplenty out there. You can see where they're taking their knives and cutting off the heads of dolls. All of them. Drive them out of the West. You better do it now, because by this time next year, it'll be 10 times harder. And they're not stopping. What, you think you can talk them out of it? You're not going to talk them out of anything. The only thing that a harsh people understand is ever more harshness. They need to be dealt with in such a harsh manner that the whole bloody lot of them becomes incontinent at the very mention of the West. And I mean it. And I've said it. Counterterrorism official said November's attacks in Paris, in which 130 people were killed and 352 injured by ISIS jihadis, could be the start of a calculated campaign. The French official, speaking on the condition of anonymity, said, unfortunately, I think 2015 was nothing. Well, it's entirely possible. I want to give you a heads up. There's no way I'm taking a sick day. It's not happening. But the weather's up and down here in Texas. It's causing coughing and sneezing and bloated sinuses and everything else. So if you're coughing or you see what is clearly a cough on the video, but you don't hear anything, it's because I got my foot right on the mute switch. Okay, so please bear with me. We'll get through it. And I'll try and drink something healthy. What would be healthy? I know. Proper cup of tea with some lemon and honey in it. China syndrome coming. Global financial meltdown. That's out of Zero Hedge. Breitbart says Twitter stock closes at another all-time low after attack on Breitbart, tech editor. What could that mean? Well, heading into the weekend, Twitter stock closed at below $20 a share for the first time in its history. And the bad news continued on Monday. Huh. Well, okay. From the All News Pipeline, the North Korean H-bomb is a super EMP. So be prepared to ride your horse and use candles to read by. If it's good enough for Abe Lincoln, it's good enough for us. What else? Oh, this is a good one from the New York Times. Now, in the why does this not surprise me department, father of Koch brothers helped build Nazi oil refinery, book says, by Nicholas Confessore. The father of the billionaire Charles G. and David H. Koch helped construct a major oil refinery in Nazi Germany that was personally approved by Adolf Hitler, according to a new history of the Kochs and other wealthy families. The book, Dark Money, by Jane Mayer, traces the rise of the modern conservative movement through the activism and money of a handful of rich donors, among them Richard Mellon Scheife, an heir to the Mellon banking fortune, and Harry and Linda Bradley, brothers who became wealthy, in part from military contracts that poured millions into anti-government philanthropy. But the book is largely focused on the Koch family, stretching back to its involvement in the far-right John Birch Society. Oh, it's really far-right. Yeah, typical New York Times, the far-right John Birch Society. See, just saying it's the far-right John Birch Society makes it sound like, oh, they're crazy. Well, they're not crazy. They believe in the Constitution as the law of the land. That's it. Look it up. Seriously, look at the John Birch Society. You may find you want to join. Okay, I digress. Maybe just divert. Anyway, the John Birch Society and the political and business activities of the father, Fred C. Koch, who found some of his earliest business success overseas in the years leading up to World War II. One venture was a partnership with the American Nazi sympathizer William Rhodes Davis, who, according to Ms. Mayer, hired Mr. Koch to help build the third largest oil refinery in the Third Reich, a critical industrial cog in Hitler's war machine. And we are surprised about this. Am I hearing it now? I think I'm hearing it now. Yep, I am. Oh, Clinton declines answers. Declines to answer a question about women involved in sex scandals. That's predictable. I'll tell you, good old Hitlery. She's something else. She really is. So, what else do we have? Oh, yes. Now, from redflagnews.com, United Nations document shared on social media says civilian gun confiscation is in the works for the United States. A reader recently sent us a realistic-looking document from the United Nations with a pretty explosive claim that the world body is moving forward with plans to help member nations disarm their civilian populations of military-grade, concealable, and hunting-grade firearms, and even ammunition and components to manufacture ammunition. Well, I mean, do you really want to hear the rest of this? All it's going to do is make you mad. Superficially, the document has the trappings of officialdom, a blue UN logo at the top, along with the name of the United Nations Office for Disarmament Affairs, a real office. It's dated August 5th, 2013, labeled restricted. But who knows if it's real or not? The fact of the matter is that little thing they have out in front of their headquarters with the gun barrel tied into a knot, that really much says it all. Pretty much says it all. You know, they're not going to get their way, but they're also not going to go easy. So here's the thing. As time goes by, and I hope this does not annoy you, and I hope it does not put you off in any way, but we're getting close to game time. And so if you hear me telling you this is not a bluff, this is not a joke, this is not a drill, we're heading toward a confrontation. Believe me, it takes quite a bit for me to say such a thing. It really does. There are plenty of gloom and doom prophets out there. I don't want to be one of them. But you can't ignore the evidence. And these people, these statists, these elitists, these globalists, they're not going easy. I think, however, they have already missed their guess. Because I predict their biggest problem will be separating those who back up their policy with arms, the ones they can trust to be on their side, and the ones who are not on their side, but within their apparatus. And these globalist elitist would-be rulers, they have no idea how large the ranks of those who oppose them really are. Remember, the enemy always provides the best opportunity for its destruction. All right. We're going to talk with Harry S. Dent, and then we're going to talk with a very interesting man named Marshall Masters. We'll give you his websites and so forth as the program continues. Very glad that you're with us. It is an honor to be of any service to you. Please stand by. We'll be right back.
This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
All right, now here he is, formidable as ever, Harry S. Dent, the founder of Dent Research, an economic forecasting firm specializing in demographic trends. His mission is helping people understand change, and nobody wants it. They know they're going to get it, but nobody wants it. But you might as well get your mind around it, because it's coming anyway. Take a look at the markets. He is a best-selling author. In his book, The Great Boom Ahead, published in 92, he really nailed it, and he stood virtually alone in accurately forecasting the unanticipated boom of the 1990s. And the continued expansion into 07. In his new book, The Demographic Cliff, he continues to educate audiences about his predictions for the next Great Depression, especially between 2014 and 2019, that he has been forecasting now for 20 years. He is the editor of the Economy and Markets newsletter and has created the H.S. Dent Financial Advisors Network. His website is harrydent.com and economyandmarkets.com. Harry, you're looking fit and strong. And sharp today, as always. How you doing? Otherwise,
good, or did I cover good. I'm one of the few people where down markets is a good thing.
Yeah, you know, it seems to me, in the depths of my ignorance, seriously, that when I see the market in the low 16,000s, I'm kind of thinking that's a good thing, as it may actually approach, you know, some semblance of reality. Am I close here?
No, you know, really, I mean, this has been one of the greatest bubbles, and we've had, I'll show a little later, we have had three bubbles since the 1990s, and each bubble has taken us to higher highs, and then we get crashes to lower lows. We're not in a reality in my forecast until we get to a lower low than we saw in early 2009, then we're in the ballpark, and that's a long, long way from here. That's why I'm so warning people that I think this is the last of the series of bubbles we've had in everything. I mean, including gold and commodities and real estate around the world, but three major bubbles in stocks. And this last one's been totally artificial, created by government stimulus and nothing else, free money, zero short-term and long-term rates, which always, always causes problems, as you know. And so I think this is the bad one. We had, you know, this before, the last great boom peaked in the mid to late 60s, and we had three higher highs and three lower lows, and bam, it was the 73-74 crash that killed investors, and stocks didn't come back to there for 25 years. So I'm warning, this is the last bubble. We're getting more and more signs, as I'll show today, that this bubble has peaked or is peaking now, and that we're going to see a bigger crash than anybody expects, especially in the next, say, year and a half.
Yeah, well, you know, when I said that, that's kind of like a good thing, and you went, no, not really. It's like, what I meant by that is it seems to me like a more realistic market would be somewhere around, I don't know, 11.5 to 12.5, somewhere in there. But it's just, with my limited knowledge of things, if 16,000 above, that has to be artificially inflated, and of course something's going to pop. And that's what I meant by that.
Yeah, and you know, John, the other thing that happened, you're right, kind of 10 to 12 would be more reasonable. But when things go overshoot on the upside, they overshoot on the downside. That's why we got to get down to 5,000 to 6,000 before we're in the ballpark. That doesn't mean it's going to stay there forever. But when I see those sort of numbers, then I can tell people, okay, now I'm starting to feel good about investing long term again, and not before then.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you that. You said 5,000 or 6,000, so you're talking half of what I said would be healthy
in 2017, in the next year and a half.
Well, let me ask you this. Who would survive such a drop? I mean, who'd be standing?
Well, the best companies always survive. It doesn't mean their stocks don't go down. They just may go down 60% instead of 90% for the ones that fail. These frackers are not going to survive. Most of the frackers are not going to survive. We were told this was a new gee whiz industry going to save America from dependence on oil. This industry was only possible because the central banks kicked back up the global economy temporarily. Oil went back to 115 after falling to 32. And on top of that, they made junk bond financing, which is what these people use, down to, you know, 5-6% instead of normally 8-10%. So these guys have gotten a free ride. This industry would have never gotten off the ground without bubble financing and a bubble economy. They're not low-cost producers like Saudi Arabia.
You know, I always come back to the same thing, Harry, and it is, What are these people thinking? I mean, surely, Harry Dent cannot be the only man out there that's going, oh, this is going to be bad, this is going to be stupid. And of course, you're not. A lot of people are saying, yeah, it's going to happen. It's going to break. It really is. But the ones who are blowing this market up like this, I mean, meaning inflating it to this ridiculous size, I mean, do they not realize what they're setting everybody up for? Or, I mean, I go back to the same old questions, but sometimes I get different answers. This is the one time that Einsteinian thing about doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Well, you know, that's crazy. But sometimes if you ask the same question enough times, you will get a different answer, and you go, and you'll have that voila moment. And it is just this. Do these things take on a life of their own? I mean, is it just negligence and nobody's watching, or people are in denial about change, or they just think the party's never going to end and the road goes on forever, like the old Robert Earl Keane song? I mean, what are these people thinking?
But yeah, it's all the above. But the thing about bubbles is, you know, on this magnitude, they only happen once in a lifetime. The last major bubble we had in the world, stocks, real estate, everything, was in the roaring 20s. Well, none of us were alive back then, or the few that are have Alzheimer's if you're lucky. So people don't understand, and as things get better over time, people kind of want to go to heaven, you know, financial heaven, I call it. And everybody wants to retire at 50 and flip stocks or flip real estate and work out of their home. And so we get in that mentality, and then all the institutions, the banks, the governments, everybody just plays on that. Hey, we want to go to heaven. We want life to be easy. We don't want it to be hard. We don't have to work hard for many, many years and save and invest and take risks. The thing about bubbles, they are so alluring because people do get to go to heaven. I mean, their house is going up 15% a year instead of the normal 3% with inflation. So they're getting something for nothing there. Governments are pushing interest rates down, and banks are making loans available, no money down and no credit check and stuff. Stocks are going up 20% a year instead of the normal 7%. Everybody's getting a free lunch, and people love a free lunch. And you look at every advertisement on TV. What do they want? They want something free, and they want a no-risk thing, and they want instant results in 7 days with no pain, and they're going to have six-pack abs. I mean, this is what people want. We act like adults, but we think like children. Because life is hard, and as you said from the beginning, people really don't like change. And I have a hard time, because when I was so bullish in the late 80s and early 90s, especially on the U.S., people are like, no, you don't understand. We're a dying country, and Japan's going to take over everything. Same thing they're saying about China today, and I'm saying the same thing. China has had it for at least a decade, and they're never going to have an economy like they have, because it's been totally artificial and rigged and government-stimulated and top-down run and kill the free markets over there. And that's not how you make wealth over time, as Adam Smith figured out in the 1700s. It's about the marriage of democracy, which brings accountability, and free markets, which encourage innovation and reward innovation and hard work and long-term investment and all these sort of things. So that's the way the world is. When you get a bubble going, people do go into denial. That's the perfect word you said. They go into denial because it's exactly what they want. Life has become easy, and I'm going to retire at age 50, and, you know, it's like winning the lottery, you know, and that's, I tell you, winning the lottery is the worst single thing that can happen to somebody in life. You'd be better to be born in a ghetto in Delhi than win the lottery in the United States, because as soon as people win the lottery, they go to sleep.
Yeah. Now, what do you make of, there was a little gurgling effect. The millennials, there are reports. Of course, you can read all the reports you want, and then after that, it's up to you to find out what's really true. But it's almost as though they're bailing out of this system. They're bailing out of everything from marriage to racking up an astronomical debt, going to a college or university so they can get a job that doesn't exist. And they're more experience oriented than productivity oriented. Mm-hmm. How does that play into our future? Does it coincide just about right with the collapse?
You know, it does. They're also getting away from 9-to-5 jobs. Everybody's working for Uber or Lyft or some courier service or something now, or some peer-to-peer or network marketing So, I mean, it's kind of natural because over time, the Bob Hope generation before the baby boom, this was a kind of a, do what's good for society generation. And then the baby boomers were much more individualistic and much more of a me generation. Now, this generation is kind of like a combination of both. They want to have more control of their lifestyle. They want to have more flexible work hours. They don't want to pay for an education that doesn't pay off anymore. They don't want to buy a home and just think it's going to automatically go up all their life, as baby boomers always assumed and were told. And I've studied real estate back hundreds of years. Real estate's just as volatile as stocks. We just lived in a rare time where we had the first middle-class generation come back from World War II and buy homes broadly, way more than in the past, on longer-term loans. And then you have the massive baby boom pump up everything on top of that. We've seen a whole lifetime of real estate goes up, 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 up. Real estate does not always go up. And real estate, for the coming decades, and I got this in Chapter 3 of my book, Real Estate Will Never Be the Same. We're going to have more old people dying in most developed countries, in Europe, United States, and places like that, and even China and Japan and Korea. More old people dying than young people coming along and buying a house, because old people are sellers. So demographics is what we focus on. Now, we focus on many things. Any good cycle, and I've got a ton of them, but the most important and projectable is we know when the average person's born. We know when they're going to enter the workforce, when they're going to get married, have kids, buy their first house, second home, first car, largest car, even potato chips at age 42. And we can project these things into the future. This is how we saw a great boom in the 90s when everybody else thought Japan was going to overtake us. Japan was at the peak of their baby boom in the late 80s, and we were just getting going along with Europe. They had a baby boom that peaked way ahead of everybody. And I've been telling everybody ever since, everybody should be studying Japan because they've gone through this big baby boom in birth and stocks and in debt and in real estate. And they have seen real estate go down now for 24 years and never come back, never, not even bounce a couple percent because of the old people dying, because they have an aging society. And so do we. And the number one aging society for the next decade, and like Japan in the 90s, is Germany. And everybody thinks Germany is going to be the country that bails out and holds Europe together. They have worse demographics and almost as bad as in Southern Europe. And those countries are already mostly bankrupt. So demographics is a powerful tool. And if we bring up the first slide, I'll just give the example for people who haven't seen it. In the United States, our baby boom, if we take the birth index and project it forward 46 years, which is the exact peak in spending of the average family, measurable today, it tells you when the economy is going to boom and bust decades in advance, and it would have told you 1983 to 2007 would be the greatest boom in history. Why? That's when the baby boomers would be spending more money as a generation. And after that 2007 peak, which again, we predicted this back in the late 80s, including the fall of Japan at the time, that all we've seen is quantitative easing ever since. Governments are now in denial saying, well, we don't want this great bubble and boom to end. Nobody wants to have a Great Depression on your watch, whether you're the Federal Reserve Chairman or the President of the United States. So they're just printing money and putting interest, creating free money, putting interest rates at zero to keep the bubble going a little longer. Just like any drug addict, I don't care how bad a shape you are, unless you're damn near dying, you can always take more of the drug and come back one more time and feel a little better before you collapse again. So this is very scary to me when I see not only that governments and financial institutions and everybody helped create this bubble and doesn't want it to end. But when the people running our country say, well, our answer is instead of restructuring debt and things like that, we're just going to create a bigger bubble. That is the definition of insanity. So demographics told us this a long time ago. Governments don't look at demographics. Economists don't understand demographics. And that's too bad, because demographics aren't taught in economics, and I didn't take economics. That's why I understand it. And so I've had to build a whole view of economics outside of normal economics, because if you look at most economists, what did they ever predict it? Did they see the collapse of Japan in the late 80s? Did they see the real estate bubble? Did they call it a bubble? Are they calling this stock bubble today a bubble when it's just as bubbly as it was from 94 to 2000 and that one crashed? No, they just follow the trends. And you know, everybody on Wall Street does too. Well, the economy's up another 2% this year, so it'll be up 2% next year. And people tell me, Harry, why are you so bearish when the economy's okay? I said, well, how do you think the economy looked in 1989 in Japan before they crashed for 25 years? How do you think it looked in 1929 at the top of our bubble in the U.S. when we were leading the world and crashed for 14 years and didn't see stocks come back for 25 years and real estate for 14 years? Think that you can't look at the present. You have to understand cycles. And like you said, people don't like change. I study change. And the reason I'm good at what I do is not because I have an IQ off the charts. It's because I'm a realist. And I study life the way it is rather than the way people want it to be.
Yeah. You know, do you think that people are moving away from this idea of globalism where the markets are concerned? And I ask that because according to that first demographic chart, the immigration chart, you know, when you have, and there's no telling if this statistic applies to the rest of the Middle East, but, you know, they're fanning out all over Europe now. Trying to get them out of there is going to be like, you know, herding cats, only worse. You know, armed and dangerous cats. But the point is, 70% of the people in Saudi Arabia are under 30 years old, or 30 years old and under, 70%. And I'm thinking, okay, we're running out of young people in Western Europe, but the Middle East isn't running out of young people at all.
Right, neither is India. China is actually running out of young people, but not India, not yet. The whole emerging world outside of China, you're right, has young people that won't peak in their spending until at least 2040, and in Africa as late as 2100. So, yeah, there's not a shortage of young people. There's a shortage of educated young people in stable societies and economies and in urban areas, because rural people don't add up to much. You know, India is still like 66% rural. The whole rural economy in India is not even a fraction of the minority urban economy. People in cities have more job opportunities, better education, easier access to technology, everything, more specialization of jobs. Even like today, what good is it going to be an Uber driver in Mayberry? You know,
right.
There's endless opportunity in New York City or any major city in this country or in the world. So that's the thing. Until the emerging world moves more into this arena, and the other thing that we keep reminding people, John, and nobody gets this. Everybody thinks that the average family in China or India down the road is going to be as rich as the average family in the United States or Germany or Japan. Not going to be the case, and not the case. Only a few countries like Singapore, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea actually made the leap from emerging country incomes of 2,000 to 5,000 up to developed to 40,000 plus. Only a few countries. China, Malaysia is one of the richest emerging countries out there. Richer per capita than China, way more than India and Indonesia, and they only make 12,000 per capita versus 55 in the U.S. They're not even a fraction of our income. So the emerging world isn't as levered, and they're doing everything later than us. The people who got the richest in the world, as usual, are the ones that do it first, the ones that urbanize first, the ones that entered the Industrial Revolution first. Great Britain, Western Europe, United States, Australia, New Zealand, and Japan. And so the emerging world is where all the growth is coming from. And I'm telling people, after this crash, that's where you have to invest. But don't expect the typical Indian citizen, even 30, 40 years from now, to be as rich as we are today.
Yeah. You know, the thing that disturbs me, and I cannot help but sort of whack science fiction-y here, but the more they try, they, whoever they are, try to interconnect the world economies, what the nasty bubble that they're setting us up for is that, yeah, we know that, I mean, South Africa for a long time was actually quite a nice place. Well, it's descended into chaos. One has only to look at Johannesburg. It doesn't look anything like it did when I was there. It looks like Detroit on Halloween every day. And I'm thinking, and I know you have to think about this stuff, Harry. You know, there are some real maniacs out there, and you don't have to agree with this, but I'm thinking Ted Turner's one of them. I think probably it was Ted Turner or one of his minions that set up that outrageous Georgia Guidestone thing with a, we must reduce the Earth's population to 500 million, and that's it. And I'm going, is this some sort of a mad scientist set up to collapse civilizations all over the world and use finance to do it?
Yeah, and I mean, that would, I hate to say it, even Donald Trump's plan to deport 11 million people, and it's probably more than that, that would cause a deep recession on its own, just the temporary loss of those jobs, those incomes and spending, and the cost of rounding them up and sending them back. We'd be in a recession on that alone, and we've got much more to worry about than that. So, I mean, the thing is, what I get from studying cycles is kind of the invisible hand back to Adam Smith in the 1700s. If you set up the right structures for government and a balance of democracy and free market capitalism, and those two things balance each other. People think democracy and free market capitalism are the same. No, they're like men and women. You know, they are opposites, because free market capitalism rewards the most productive, and democracy gives everybody a say so the everyday person doesn't get abused by the power, which has happened all throughout history. So you set up the right system and the right rules, things grow by themselves. Trees grow by themselves. You just give them a little better water, a little better soil, access to sunlight, prune them properly, they grow better. But they grow by themselves. You know, this is an organic process. We've been evolving for thousands of years and even zillions by something. And things get better. When people talk about the good old days, I'm like, don't put me in a time machine. I'm not going back to Roman times where 98% of people were slaves and 2% of people controlled everything, you know, or where most people could barely grub and just that basic task. I even go to the backwoods of India and countries today. People have to work incredibly hard just to get water and a little firewood. And a little goat milk. I mean, because they don't have electricity and all these machines and cars and all these things we have. So things grow. What really makes me mad is that people who should be smarter don't study history, and they think, oh, we don't need these natural processes. We don't need booms and busts. We don't need inflation and deflation. We don't need democracy anymore. Democracy's a pain. We don't need free markets. We'll just set, you know, we'll let the Federal Reserve set interest rates the way they want to and give everybody what they want, free money. Every time there's a recession, they'll make the cold go away. I get mad at doctors who sit there and say, we got to cure the common cold. I said, the common cold's the only thing that keeps you healthy, you idiots. The natural process has developed over zillions of years. People have no respect for these natural processes and cycles. Our economy works as good as it does in the countries where it's done so well, like the United States, because it is a dynamic play of opposites. You have to have the opposites. As soon as you eliminate recessions, you'll never have innovation again. The greatest innovations come in times of inflation and deflation, not a normal 0 to 2% inflation. Economists want a heaven world of 2% inflation, 3, 4% growth, and no recessions. That is such a misunderstanding of what made us wealthy and what creates wealth over time, and evolution and higher standards of living, even higher morality, that I just can't even believe educated people are saying this, but it's they're just doing what seems to work in the short term, and they're not understanding the dynamics. I mean, again, what has made us rich? And so they're killing capitalism. They're killing democracy. Basically, special interests have taken over, hijacked democracy, and central banks have hijacked the markets. And we no longer have these dynamics. And guess what? Japan was the first to do this in the early 90s, and guess what? For 25 years, they've been in a coma economy. They've grown zero. They've had zero inflation, zero innovation, zero everything, because they're in an emergency room on life support. That's what they've come down to, because they don't want to let their stupid banks go under who made bad loans. They don't want to restructure debt. You know, they don't want to deal with the old getting old and who are taking excessive benefits and killing the young people who have part-time jobs and are lucky to work for Uber, you know? So, you know, I just try to educate people and say, first of all, you can see the future. I can project inflation decades in advance, regardless of monetary policies, even though they may veer from it short-term. I can project when economies will grow in the emerging world and developed world, decades in advance. I've got cycles that boom and bust every 10 years, every 30 years in commodities. Geopolitics gets bad for 17 to 18 years, like 2001 to 2019, and we got more ahead of us. I can guarantee you that. Just like it was good from 1983 to 2000, 18 years where almost nothing went wrong in the world. So you can see the big cycles. You can look at reality, and you can make the most of it instead of living in la-la land and hoping that some economist is going to create utopia where we grow at 3 to 4% a year with 2% inflation and we never have a recession again.
Yeah, that's interesting. It's a little bit more than interesting. It spawns so much. What you're saying spawns so many more questions. It's like you were talking about people living in India. It's like they got to go through hell to get a little firewood. They got to walk a long way to get some water that's potable, you know, firewood, water, goat milk, just to get by. And you go, well, is it even right to go, hey, India, we'd like to pull you into our version of the 21st century. What do you say? I mean, what about mind your own business? Is that just not possible?
Well, you know, there's a balance between that, too. We do affect each other globally, and there needs to be some global integration, and yet countries need to have their own strategies, their own laws, their own borders and things like that. And Europe's disintegrating rapidly after trying to become la-la land. But there's a reality. It's just like in the United States. Even in this country, we could send everybody to Harvard. Let's say we gave everybody a free Harvard, Yale, Princeton education. Would there be enough jobs for all those people? And who would do all of the other jobs unless we suddenly had robots? One of these days we might, but the reality is here and around the world, even if we try to bring, there's no way to bring India up to our standard of living. There are only so many high-tech, professional, financial, technical jobs in the world, and there's so many high-value-added industries, and they've already been taken. Computers, software, healthcare, global finance, high-end electrical appliances and automobiles. Most countries, even most developed countries, don't produce automobiles or dominate high-end appliances or TVs. There's only so many jobs in that. So the emerging world has always ended up, even though they get better infrastructures and a little better education and better systems and automobiles and roads and things and sewers if they're lucky and electricity, there's still somebody's got to produce the commodities and the raw material.
Yeah.
And one of these days that may change, but that's the reason that even though countries do urbanize like we did in a century or so ago in Europe, U.S. and Europe, and do get automobiles and do get roads and all these things and even computers. As wealthy as the United States. And for now, that's not going to change. What is going to change, though, these emerging countries are growing in population, having more kids, even at slower rates, and we are, most of the Western world, is going to be shrinking, not just slowing in population growth, shrinking and shrinking even faster in workforce growth with these aging societies. And the way we think, and this is the flip side of being wealthy, wealthy people living in urban areas think, I want to have one, maybe two kids, because it costs a lot to live in urban areas and raise kids that don't work on the farm and support themselves and all this sort of stuff. So I want to have one or two. That's very hard to change. And that's why the Western world and the developed countries are slowing. And despite the fact that we'll be richer as families and as cities and stuff, I'm going to be investing in India after this crash and in Southeast Asia and other parts of the emerging world, because that's where the growth is. Even if people are growing from 2,000 per year to 15,000 a year instead of growing up to 50,000 a year, that's where the growth is going to be. And going from 2,000 a year to 15,000 a year is 7 times growth.
Oh, yeah. It looks like Vietnam might be a good play, yeah?
Vietnam's like little China, we call it. I mean, you go over there, Southeast Asia, the work ethic is unbelievable. These people can put a family of 7 on a motorbike with plywood and groceries, and I've seen it.
Yeah.
That's how creative they are. Indians can deal in traffic that we would have no hope driving in with elephants on the road and monkeys and cows stopping traffic just to urinate and bicycles and kids. It's just crazy. They can deal with it. A U.S. driver would not have a chance driving in India. They're still not adventures up. They're creative, but they are in a different world. And one of these days that may change, but we would have to have technologies that were so good at producing commodities and everyday services that you wouldn't need that anymore. And everybody could be a professional or an entrepreneur or something. And that's just not the case today. There's only so many of those jobs.
Yeah. Is it me or has South Korea pretty much done it right?
Well, I tell you that the two miracles of recent times, Japan went from 5,000 per capita income to, 40,000 in 3 decades, the fastest of any emerging country in history. And then South Korea did the same thing on a 2-decade lag. I lecture a lot in South Korea. For some reason, my books do really well over there with no promotion. So when I'm talking over there, I say, you know what you are? You are Japan on a 22-year lag. That is exactly the peak of your two baby booms. 1949 for the Japanese and 1971 for South Korea. South Korea still has a baby boom on an upward slope, but only till 2018, only 3 more years. And then they go off the demographic cliff, just like Japan did in the 90s and U.S. did in 2008. You got to remember, we predict all these things. I was the only economist that saw Japan collapsing in the 90s when everybody thought they were about to become the number one country and saw the U.S. boom slowing and Europe to follow after 2007. And, Korea's the last. And they have done everything right. They have moved into high-valued industries. They have valued education. They have urbanized. I go to Seoul. I had no idea how pretty Seoul was. It's an old and a new city at once. It's modern. It's got beautiful mountains, nice people. Some of the food's a little hard to swallow. But other than that, I was shocked at how nice Seoul was. I said, boy, they just spoke English over here. Well, I'd consider moving here.
Yeah.
Wow. But they don't.
But they don't.
That's the one thing they've done wrong. They don't. I told some government people over there, I would, starting today, and you should have done this 20 years ago, every kid should learn English as a second language. And your university should teach in English, ultimately.
Now, I know you have a number of slides that you want to bring up at some point, but let me ask you about gold. Gold will not protect you as it is an inflation hedge, and we are in a deflationary era due to the deleveraging of unprecedented debt and financial bubbles. Deleveraging. What does that mean, Harry? I sense it, but I don't know it.
Well, let me give another example so some people can understand. Let's say you eat bad sushi or anything, you drank a gallon of poisonous stuff or something. Now you've got bad stuff in your body. What does your body do? What does it know how to do after thousands and thousands of years of evolution? It flushes it out through every orifice possible.
Yep.
It's detox, it's called. That's what happens. When we go too long in a boom, people want to borrow more. They want to live off the debt instead of their real productivity. They want to get rich quick. They want to flip stocks, flip real. People start speculating instead of working and producing. And they go too long without innovation and stuff. So you get all this debt. You get all these bubbles in your economy, which are really imbalanced. So what the economy tried to do in 2008, and this is not like an analogy. This is exactly what happened. All of a sudden, the economy goes down. All this debt starts flushing out. All these firms start failing. All these derivatives blow up. Bank loans go bad. What does the government do? Say, well, for every trillion lost, we're just going to throw another trillion in. We're not going to let this. We're going to take a pill. And this is what doctors do. Somebody gets a cold. Somebody gets a headache. What do they do? Here's a pill to stop this. I'm like, why would you want to stop your body from eliminating bad stuff? That's what it does for a living. That's why you're alive and as healthy as you are. So even doctors are kind of like economists. They see themselves as solving symptoms instead of creating health and growth. And that's what economists do. They just want to run the economy this way. It's so simple. And it is because people are in denial. They want, they're in this life of change and growth. We do not grow and evolve without change. But they don't like the change. They like the good part of the change. They don't like the challenge. They like the nurturing. They like mommy to hug them and tell them they're wonderful. They like to be taken care of, but they don't like to have to, get a little kick and have to, deal with some difficult things. That's how you grow. Everybody I know that's very successful did not get born with a spoon in their mouth. They had to go through challenges, and the people that did get born with a golden spoon in their mouth or silver spoon or whatever, they're all like, you know, alcoholics and doing nothing and don't know how to do anything in life because they got too taken care of. You need nurturing, but you also need challenge. But we all buy the nurturing. Like I said, they want the instant success. 7 days to six-pack abs, you know, with no pain. There is no way to get six-pack abs with no pain.
Right, right. Now let me ask you this. Inflation, that's pretty easy to figure out, even for the layman, how that happens. But deflation, I'm not sure people understand what deflation really is, meaning that in an inflationary period, if as your hedge against inflation, your gold that you bought for, say, $1,000 an ounce is now worth $2,000 an ounce because you're paying a lot more for absolutely everything else because you have to throw more currency at it to buy the same thing you bought last week. You know, milk's $5 a gallon now instead of $2 a gallon or whatever. But what is happening, Harry, when you enter a deflationary period? Or rather, what has happened when that arrives on your doorstep?
When you see deflation, especially extended like in the 1930s or the 1870s or the 1840s, I mean, you've seen this. We can study this throughout history.
Yeah.
These always follow debt bubbles, which cause an economy to overexpand in a boom, and it also creates asset bubbles. The more debt there is, the more money floating around that's not real, that you didn't really earn, you just got from a bank loan suddenly against your house or whatever, or you borrowed money 10 to 1 to buy stocks. You got all that free money and extra money around, you get bubbles in assets and you get debt bubbles, and the whole economy overexpands and invests in speculative stuff instead of real stuff that produces long-term jobs and growth. When that bubble, when that detox happens, like the sushi coming out, that's deflation. It's taking inflation and especially debt and asset bubbles out of the economy because they're toxic. They're not good for the economy. Bubbles never end well. Bubbles never build wealth. They're short. You're living on the short term at the expense of the long term. Debt. It's fine to buy a house on a 30-year mortgage because you're going to live in it that long and raise your kids. It's not fine to take your equity out of your house and then use that to finance a vacation home and to buy some speculative real estate down the street. And that's what people did in the real estate bubble. Bubbles always cause misallocations of resources. Bubbles always come because you boom too long and people don't think the economy can go down anymore. And because governments always think whatever we're growing at isn't good enough, so they're going to make money cheaper, and they're going to make loans cheaper. They're going to artificially stimulate the economy. And that's just like taking crack or caffeine or alcohol or something else. You're taking a drug to overstimulate your economy. Taking drugs regularly or stimulants of any type never work out well either. You do a little bit, it's okay. You know, a cup of coffee a day is okay. 8 cups of coffee a day is not okay. So, this is what happens. So when you see deflation, that's what's happening. You've had a long boom. It's turned into a bubble. That bubble was fueled by debt. And now we got to wash these excesses out of our economy. Why? So the next generation can afford to buy a stupid house again so that we don't have all this debt and interest on our backs for consumers and businesses forever because it was a waste and it was a misallocation in the first place. So it's a good thing. We had the worst time in U.S. history in the 1930s, but from the 1930s forward, we grew and became the greatest power in the world after the greatest depression. And we had a bigger depression than Europe did because we overexpanded more than they did in the bubble. We had a bigger bubble. We had a bigger burst. But we were the up-and-coming emerging country at the time, about to become a developed country, and Europe was slower. So we came out of it stronger than ever, but the detox was part of it. We went from a 2x GDP debt down to 60% GDP debt between the Great Depression and World War II after spending money to fight a war. So we detoxed a lot of debt out of the economy, and we didn't have any bubbles in the 50s and 60s. We had booms. We didn't have bubbles. When you see bubbles, you know you're in trouble. And I've been warning this for years, and people like, Harry, it's not a bubble. It's not a bubble. And I'm like, I'm sorry. Looks like a bubble. Quacks like a bubble. It's a bubble. And I've never seen more bubbles, and there's not a bigger bubble on the earth, nothing to even compare to China.
You know what?
And economists worship China and think they're a modern miracle. They have overexpanded their economy so far. They're going to fall so hard, they're not going to get up for at least a decade.
Do you know, it's funny, because I used to say, and I'm no economist, Harry, I'm not, but I used to say all the time, I don't think I'd bet it. I'd push all my chips onto the China square, because they haven't been at this game as long as we have. And they're going to go like hell for a little while, but then something bad is going to happen. And that's effectively what you've just said. And that's a genius quote that you just made. Bubbles always cause misreallocation of resources. And you know what? And then you used the term detox. It really is like drug addiction.
Yeah.
It really is. Drink, want more drink. Drug, want more drug. Right?
Because debt is a financial drug. You know, just like heroin is a pharmaceutical drug or whatever, or alcohol or caffeine. These things are drugs. They enhance short-term performance at the expense of long-term health. That's what growing too fast does. And no country has moved more people so fast from rural to urban areas, which is natural to do. It's just don't do a 500 million people in 20 years. That's what China did. That is insanity. There is no way that can work out. No way that cultural traditions and society can keep from coming unglued when you make that massive a shift and it's not organic. The government forced this stuff. The government buys the land from the people, builds condos on that land for nobody, and they're still sitting there empty, and then moves these people with no skills into the major cities, and they have them build stuff and condos and stuff there for nobody. This is insanity.
Yeah.
What's wrong with the Chinese, if they have totally 100% ignored the two principles I mentioned earlier, free market capitalism and democracy, that made the wealthy countries wealthy in the first place? They think they can just financially engineer it, just like the Fed thinks it, just like Bernanke thinks it, and Greenspan thought it, and Janet Yellen thought it. These people, to me, don't know crap about anything. I don't care what you know about interest rates or this or that and that and all the little parts. If you misunderstand the big picture this much, you're going to make really bad decisions, and this is not going to go down well in history.
Wow. All right, tell you what.
They created a bubble, and then instead of restructuring it, they created a bigger bubble to solve the bubble. They thought, oh, if we got too much debt, the answer is more debt. Oh, if we got too much bubbles, let's create bigger bubbles. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard, ever.
Yeah. I hope this isn't the stupidest thing that you've ever heard, but it's almost like you can build this engine, you can build this racing car, but once you get into it, if you can't tell what that machine is willing to do, if you can't sense where the power curve is and at which point, don't push it any farther, because you're either going to make less horsepower than you were, or you're going to destroy the engine. If you don't have that feel for the machine, then you're not going to. There's not going to be any consistent success here.
Right. If you don't have the experience to take a hard curve at a high speed, you're going to go off the road, and that's exactly what's going to happen to China. This has not happened in Indonesia. A lot of emerging countries have not done the same thing, but Southeast Asia and Korea at first overdid it. Governments overinvested, overexpanded, took on too much debt, and they had a big crisis from 1997 to 2002. Well, that was a 4 or 5 year crisis, and I remember being in Thailand at the time with my kids, and I said, do not cash your dollars till the last minute you're going to spend it. That's how fast the Thai baht was falling or whatever. So this is what happened. Now imagine China did what these countries did, overexpanded, twice as long, 2 to 3 times as intense. I mean, I can't find a comparison in history. The British didn't expand that fast. The United States didn't urbanize this fast or expand or take on this much debt in the same state. China is going down. And anybody thinks that China is going to save this global economy is going to be very, very wrong. And China's bubble is bursting, which is why I'm now convinced that this global bubble, I think China is the number one trigger, along with falling oil prices, which we already also forecasted in commodity prices years ago, and the future fall of Germany and in Southern Europe again. But China's the biggest bubble going to burst, because when their bubble bursts, not only does their economy, people get scared, But the marginal buyers of real estate in the leading cities around the world, English-speaking cities, are the Chinese. And when they stop buying in London and New York and San Diego and San Francisco and L.A. and Vancouver and Toronto and Singapore and Sydney and Melbourne, you're going to see a global real estate collapse. So this is the trigger. It's not the problem. You can't have a collapse without having imbalances and bubbles and debt. But it takes a trigger. And in 2008, four states in the United States had a subprime crisis. Only four states, if you look at it, California, Nevada, Arizona, Florida, and it triggered a global stock collapse and many real estate bubbles burst around the world. It's just a trigger, but China's going to be that trigger. And the Federal Reserve can't do a darn thing about it.
Speaking of triggers now, where is the warfare component in all this, Harry? Because it seems like a lot of people are saying, well, the solution to every really serious economic crisis is war. Do you see it that way?
Well, we did. People think we came out of the Great Depression because of World War II.
Yes.
Certainly that was a stimulant. Wars are always stimulating the economy, and stock markets most of the time go up in wars. They don't go up a lot because of the inflation and some of the side effects and risk, but stock markets do not fear wars like they do recessions and depressions. But this time we don't have we have the basis for what I'd call a mini World War III. It's basically the Middle East and Russia. But we don't have the leading powers of the world. The largest countries are the United States. And, of course, Europe, if you take as a whole. And then China and Japan. None of these countries are going to war against each other like in World War II. So I don't think war is a big enough solution. I think deflation's going to offset that. But we do have, in addition to our demographic cycles, we do have a geopolitical cycle, which is about 35 years, 17 to 18 years good, 17 to 18 years bad. We are in a bad one, and it's not going to start to turn up till about 2020. So all these problems in the Middle East, all these tensions with Russia and everything else are going to continue to stay bad for at least the next 4 years. That's not good for the stock market. The stock market only does half as good in a bad geopolitical world than it does in a 1983 to 2000 good geopolitical world. Or, you know, like 1947 to 65 was a positive geopolitical cycle. Stocks always do better. So this is not only are we seeing more and more demographic problems and slowing in China and Europe and U.S. and everywhere, we're also seeing worse and worse terrorism, geopolitical news, and that wears on the stock market. That's why, I mean, the stock market is trying to go to new highs like it always has since this stimulus in 2008 and 2009, and it just can't do it anymore. It's just too much bad news. And at some point, and I think we're coming across that soon, the traders are going to get, oops, something's changed. We're no longer buying the dips. We're going to start shorting this market. Then it's over.
Harry, did you want to put a... I'm sorry, I stepped on you. What'd you say?
Well, I think that's going to happen quickly. I think the most important chart that I always show is what I call this Dow megaphone pattern. This chart says there's a bigger bubble burst, particularly in 2016. What we saw is each bubble, the first bubble was in early 2000, the tech bubble, and then we had a crash. Well, then we had a bubble took us higher in 2007. Then we had a deeper crash. And then this bubble now is peaking in 2015. And I'm showing that the next crash will take us to lower lows, like 5,500 to 6,000 on the Dow. That is a 70% decline from here. So anybody thinks, most people are admitting, well, maybe we'll have a 20% correction in stocks. I think the next correction is going to be 70% minimum, and ultimately we're going to go lower than that before we wash out all these bubbles. But this is the time, I think 2016, I just came out in my newsletter and said, it'll be the worst year for stocks very likely since 1931, worse than 2008, worse than 2001, if you remember those, worse than 73, 74. Those are the worst crashes in our lifetime. In 1 year, we're going to see more damage to the stock market if this megaphone pattern's right. And this is the most likely pattern. And I know governments will try to fight this, but they've been trying to fight it, and the Chinese bubble is bursting anyway. And I tell you, within months, that China bubble is going to burst again, and that's going to trigger the next round of stock and real estate crashes around the world.
Let me ask you, you just answered the next question. It's like we're going to pull the rest of the world down with us, aren't we?
Well, China's the real trigger. We're not the trigger this time. We're the best house in a bad neighborhood. We were the trigger last time. Canada, Australia, other countries, despite equal real estate boom, did not have the irresponsible lending. So we triggered that, and in a whole junk bond crisis, and then derivatives, and the whole leverage thing and bubble fell apart. So we were the trigger. We were not the cause. We were one of the cause. We were the trigger. China is the trigger. Oil prices are the other big trigger. And again, we've been saying this for the last year. Watch the price of oil. It's going to 30, 32 bucks. Well, guess what? That's where we're at. It'll bounce at some point. Ultimately, it's going to 10 to 20 bucks, and then there won't be any crackers standing. Wow. And how much debt, hundreds of billions of dollars of debt will default just because of that alone? That's not enough to create a worldwide crisis, just to trigger. But again, it's the China bubble. The Japanese were the leading edge investors in real estate and business around the world because of their bubble in the 80s. They had a bubble when nobody else did. The Chinese are that now. The Japanese were a trigger in the past for real estate going down. The Chinese are going to be a trigger for a whole global collapse. So watch that Chinese market. It is close to breaking to a new low. Once it does, it was at 5,200 at the top. It went to 2,800 recently, bounced. It'll be at 1 to 2,000 within a year. And that's what to watch.
Cool. Well, now,
not a thing the ECB or the Fed can do about that. They can print all the money they want. They cannot reverse that extreme bubble that the Chinese government created by building trillions and trillions and trillions of stuff for nobody and creating $30 trillion of debt in an emerging country, which normally would only be able to, the size of their economy, handle $10 trillion of debt. Greatest bubble in modern history.
Just remind us of this, Harry. What is the difference between recession and depression?
Depressions are when you see that deflation. That's what's unique. I mean, we've had deep recessions before. 1980 to 82, we had 11% unemployment. We had near 10 in 73, 74, 75 recession. We had 10 to 11 in 2008. Those are deep recessions. And in fact, there's been depressions that have had unemployment at those levels. A depression only comes typically once in a lifetime, like the 1930s, when a major debt bubble and the asset bubbles that form around it. When you see a debt bubble, there are going to be bubbles in assets like real estate and stocks and commodities every single time. Yeah. It's when those bubbles detox, deflate, deleverage, whatever you want to call it, and you see money disappear. Now, I'll just give you a quick example. We've got a chart. I don't have that with me, but we now have $225 trillion of financial assets in the world, loans, bonds, stocks. That's not even counting real estate. $100 trillion of that will disappear in the next 4 to 5 years minimum. What happens when $100 trillion of real money and wealth disappears, just like magic?
I don't know.
All this Federal Reserve lending and fractional reserves and bubbles and stuff and super low interest rates, you create it by magic and then it disappears. When $100 trillion disappears, there's that much less money. There's, let's say, 60% as much money in the system chasing the same consumer goods and the same financial assets and real estate. That means the price of everything goes down. It's like a waterfall. You go to this level and you go off a cliff and start at a new level. It's like a waterfall.
Yeah, the price of everything goes down and nobody has any money.
Right. So, but the secret is, and what we look at in our books and our newsletters and stuff, if you're one of the smart people that gets out near the top of the bubble and has and preserves your cash and cash flow, then the world's going to be on sale. It doesn't matter whether you want a Ferrari or a beachfront house or to buy into a great company like Coca-Cola when they're down 80%. You're going to be able to buy. It's going to be the greatest financial sale of a lifetime. And it only comes once in a lifetime. And 99 out of 100 people will never get that opportunity because they won't see the bubble bursting because people are blind to bubbles. And so are our leaders.
All right. So for people who, and you're thinking this is going to be the worst year for stocks, but I'm guessing you're thinking it's going to really be stupid in 2017. That's when it'll hit the wall.
No, I think we're going to see the worst declines in 2000. This is going to be like 2008 replay. We saw the worst of the crash in 2008, especially the second half of the year. But the market didn't bottom until March of 2009. And then we got this another bubble. Now, The truth is, when we look at all of our indicators, demographic, geopolitical, innovation, boom bust cycles, we've got four primary indicators. They don't really start to turn up largely until the early part of the next decade. So we don't come out of this winter season or slump or depression for 4, 6, maybe 7 years. But I think you're going to see the worst of the decline in stocks by early to mid 2017, if not sooner. It's going to happen the next year, year and a half, is what I'm saying. So this is the time to protect. Real estate took 6 years from top to bottom in the last crash. Stocks only took 17 months. That's the difference. Stocks move faster. Commodities move faster. So you got to protect yourself foremost in stocks. And even, again, people thinking, oh, gold's low, it's goodbye. No, it's not a goodbye. Oil at 30 bucks, not a goodbye yet. 10 bucks, yes. Gold at 250 to 400, yes. We're not there yet. But real estate, the problem with real estate, it may take longer to decline, but real estate gets illiquid very quickly. So I'm telling people, same thing. Don't think if we have another crash in stocks, it's not going to be followed by another crash in real estate. And real estate is still way overvalued. We have not even come close to erasing the bubbles here and around the world. And in China, don't even talk to me about how much Chinese real estate could fall. 80-90%.
So when you talk about, when you hear people talk about how these countries, China and this one and that one, they're buying gold, they're accumulating as much gold as possible, this is not a good strategy.
Not a good strategy. They're just as dumb as investors. I mean, if China's dumb enough to overbuild their economy with 27% vacant condos, the biggest mall in the world that they've had to turn into a tourist park because they have no stores in it, and everything else, if they're that stupid to overbuild for that long, then why would they be smart in buying gold? Gold is the worst thing to buy right now. Gold has crashed. I saw a commercial on TV the other day. Gold is the safest investment. Stocks have been crashing. No, I'm sorry. Stocks haven't been crashed much yet. Gold's been crashing since 2011. Gold has been more volatile than anything other than oil and silver.
I'll tell you what, man. There are, you know, Arthur C. Clarke said, for every expert, there's an equal and opposite expert. But I have to tell you, you make an awful lot of sense. You really do. And my compliments, because, Harry, you pretty much stand alone in your views on this. But so far, you haven't missed yet, have you?
No, I mean, I can be a little early, a little late, a little high, a little low. But when we call for a major change like the collapse of Japan or a switch from, you know, low inflation to deflation, we're never wrong about that because we understand the natural flow of events. There's four seasons in the economy. You get a mild inflationary boom like the 40s, 50s, and 60s. You get a high inflation bust like the 70s. You get a disinflationary bubble boom like the 80s, 90s, and 2000s. And then you get a winter season with deflation. End of story. It has never, ever, ever happened any other way.
Wow.
So we're right about the seasons and the cycles. I can always be a little too early. I was early on this one. I was especially trying to get people out at 17,300 a little over a year ago. Well, the market went 1,000 points higher, but it's already at 16,200 recently. So bubbles burst faster than they build, so you better to get out a little early. But yes, I'm the guy you should listen to because everybody else is just extrapolating trends and listening to other economists who don't understand the basis of the economy. Again, they know a lot about it. These are highly educated people. They don't understand the beast itself. And I do because I've studied it and I've run businesses. I've started businesses. I've consulted the Fortune 100 businesses. I've invested in businesses. I know real life business and I understand consumers and I study consumers. I can tell you from cradle to grave when they weigh the most, when they eat the most calories, when they spend the most money on potato chips or camping equipment or anything. Nobody knows consumers better than I do. So listen to me if you want the facts. If you want ideology and heaven on earth and what people would like to see happen, then listen to most politicians or economists because that's what they're going to tell you.
I don't listen to those guys, Harry. I roll with you. And that is why you have gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And that's why we call you Sir Harry Dent. Hey, thanks a lot for the time. And let's reconvene. It'll be very interesting. We'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about some stuff.
Yeah. This will be a good year to reconvene, I promise you.
All right. God bless, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Wow, is he something or is he something? I mean, look at the track record. That's all you have to do. That's all you have to do. Okay. Let's see. What are we going to do? We're going to do some stuff here. Yep. I'm going to talk to Mr. Masters. Come on.
This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
And now we look forward to our conversation with Mr. Marshall Masters, former CNN Science Features News producer, freelance writer, television analyst, and the publisher of Yowza.com. Y-O-W-U-S-A, Yowza. I get it. Since 1999, he's been researching Earth changes and Nibiru flyby related topics, including sustainable survival communities, catastrophic crop circles, impact events, and future technologies. Like many others, Mr. Marshall sees a dark cloud coming. What makes him different is that he also sees a silver lining, a noble and inspiring Star Trekian future. His books, Crossing the Cusp, Planet X Forecast, and the 2012 Survival Guide, and the new one, Being in It for the Species, The Universe Speaks. Wow, and when the universe speaks, I'd say we would do well to listen. Welcome, Mr. Masters. Thanks for making the time for us. Good to have you here.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, so, and now NASA has... Do your studies correlate to NASA's recent, maybe they've had it for a long time, but we've just heard about in the last couple of days, they're like official Armageddon office as far as space-related objects flying by, threatening the Earth and all of that?
Actually, that would be consistent with the trend that we're seeing. And There's two things that we're monitoring right now that are harbinger signs of the approaching Planet X system: earthquakes and fireballs. And if you look at what we see with earthquakes, we've been tracking them, and there's a lot of disinformation out there in terms of how they set the point for the magnitude of the quakes. We look from 4.0 and above, and others that'll say, well, it's really going down, are looking at 5.0 and above. But, you know, it's just where you peg the statistics. You can see that we're just experiencing a substantial and massive increase in the number of quakes since 1970. All right. And interestingly enough, you know, with this chart, 1970, I was in high school, and I could remember all the conversation about us being in a binary star system with another sun called Nemesis. And then that conversation just seemed to die away inexplicably. Years later, I came back to it as a researcher. But if you look at, in terms of earthquakes worldwide from 1970 to 2014, substantial increase. Now, you know, then they're going to say, well, that's because we have more reporting stations and all of that. That might make a difference of 10%, but it's not going to explain such a huge increase. However, the one that really troubles us the most are going to be the monthly total fireballs. This is something we are tracking consistently. And here's a graph that we published in our recent signs article on our site at YOWUSA.com. And this one is showing for 2013, 2014, 2015. And what you're seeing is an overall consistent trend. However, in November of 2015, the reporting data from AMS, American Meteor Society, just simply jumped off the chart and far, far, far above what we actually statistically trended for November. So if we're seeing this, all right, in November, and now NASA is throwing a lot of money into this meteor watch, well, it makes sense.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned earthquakes also. And
That's right.
I mean, this is really kind of complex. Let's see if we can merge all of this stuff. This Planet X has been has been buzzing us over millennia, I take it. And a couple of researchers, Gil Broussard comes to mind, Jonathan Kahn comes to mind. There are biblical references, as I understand it, to this. And it's not, it doesn't go into a great deal of detail, but it's definitely there. And I just wonder, just kind of take it from there, Marshall, and just take us where you want to go with that. Because this, you know, for a long time before I got into this, I mean, even to the depth that I have, I thought, yeah, whatever. And now it's like, no, it's not whatever. This is a real thing. And it is, isn't it?
It is. It's very real. And the, if you're going to use, in a flyby scenario, Planet X system is a brown dwarf with its own mini constellation cluster of planets and moons. And it's in a very steep incline to the ecliptic, the plane of our solar system, coming up, swooping around the sun, and then going way back south again. And it does that in a 3,600-year orbit. But it's also twisting around. It's kind of a corkscrew. So it's going up and down, but it's also going around at the same time. And think of it like a carousel in the amusement park. You're on the horse, and the horse is going up and down, and the carousel is going around. So you're moving on two axes. Same thing with the Planet X system. It's moving around the sun about every 380 days. But it takes 3,600 years for it to go from one end of its orbit to the other. And That's the reason why it's behind the sun right now, starting to pop out, and we're merging with it because we're just a little faster than it is, and that's the reason why these objects are coming out from behind the sun. And there's two flyby scenarios, and both are rooted in the biblical stories of Noah and the flood and the 10 plagues of Exodus. Now, there's also a corollary to this. There's a ancient wisdom text, secular text, called the Colbran Bible, and it was penned by the ancient Egyptians and then later by the Celts in the second half of it. Now, what it does is it goes into much more detail on these two allegorical accounts in the Bible, really fleshes it out. And what the Colbran Bible says is both of these events were the result of flybys. Now, what's the difference between a best case and a worst case scenario? Best case scenario is going to be where it reaches perigee, all right? And not to be confused with perihelion. Perihelion is where it comes closest to the sun. Perigee is where it comes closest to Earth. You know, all politics are local. So as they say in real estate, location, location, location. And if it reaches perigee, its closest distance to the Earth, when the sun is in between Earth and the Planet X system, then that is a best case scenario flyby. That was Exodus. However, Noah's flood was a worst case scenario, where Earth and the Planet X system were on the same side of the sun when it came to perigee. Now, a lot of folks, you know, when you look at the story of Noah and the flood, in the Colbran Bible, it's the story of Sesuda and Hanok. And what we are told is that the flood was caused by 40 days, you know, 40 days and 40 nights of rain. And scientists have said, well, that's nonsense because there's not enough surface water. Well, yeah, that argument, if you're going to be limited that way. But if you're trying to find the truth of the matter, what it really is that's the last of the flyby, the 40 days and 40 nights, because when we pass through the tail of this system, our atmosphere just gets loaded. And so we have a huge period of incredibly heavy rains, and that would cause essentially 40 days and 40 nights. So allegorically, it's correct. It's something that happens after the deluge, not before. So then if it's the 40 days and 40 nights happens after the deluge, where's the deluge coming from? Well, go back and then both the Bible, or the Tanakh, that's the five books of Moses. And there you're going to go and have absolute provenance, because that is the very exact Hebrew it was penned in that we read today. So I go to the five books of Moses, the Tanakh or Torah. And that tells us that Noah built the ark on the side of a hill. Now, if you're working with a banker to finance your ark, the logical thing to do is build it in the bay, so that if your disaster doesn't happen, no problemo. Turn it into a hotel and casino, and you clean up. And, you know, happy ending. On the other hand, if you're having a pole shift event, and a pole shift event is going to be a crustal shift, you're going to have a magnetic where the north and south pole flip. That's a magnetic shift. A crustal shift is where the skin of the planet, the lithosphere, it literally shifts. Now, when that happens, all of the major basins of water, all the major bodies of water come out of their basins. And the I've got a guy with a weed blower by me, so I hope it doesn't bother us.
No, can't even hear him.
And the thing about it is that if you are going to have a wall of water because a massive tsunami, mile-high tsunami, is coming because the oceans are being displaced. If it hits a bay, coastal areas, those areas are going to be absolutely devastated. Whatever's there is immediately going to be chewed up to doll rags. But then that massive wave is going to continue inland. Now, as it's crossing over the land, it is losing energy rapidly. And so at some point, that wave will ebb and then return back. By Noah building the ark on the side of a hill, strategically located, the wave that came in from the pole shift, the crustal pole shift, ebbed just as the waters were going underneath the keel of the ark, as opposed to going over the ark and crushing it to pieces. And then the waters lifted the ark off the yokes and drew it out to sea. And so that explains what's going to happen with a pole shift event. Coastal areas are going to be devastated. Now, the question then becomes, in this flyby that we're going to experience, is this is going to be a best case scenario where Planet X system reaches perigee when the sun is between us? Or is it going to be a worst case scenario where the sun is not between us, we're both on the same side of the sun? The call was made on that actually in a 2008 interview with Bob Dean. He's a government whistleblower, highly secure rated. I've had a chance to talk with him. He's a very fine gentleman, upstanding. And his sources were telling him in 2008 that this would be a worst case scenario, that we would both be on the same side of the sun. So we're looking at a pole shift event, which is a direct concern for everyone who lives along coastal areas. And the vast majority of humanity lives in these danger zones.
Well, my goodness. You know, I wonder. No, they can't be that smart. There seems to be this this push by government agencies to move people off the coastlines and get them centered in cities that are well inland. They can't be that smart, can they?
Well, what they're doing is you're seeing a lot of government agencies that are relocating inland to the flyover states. And however, what we are seeing, while they're moving government agencies, the thing that they're not doing is they're not moving the general populace off the coastlines. In fact, what I am seeing is a concerted effort by the governments to keep as much of human population as possible on the coastlines, which would therefore create a massive die-off event.
No kidding. You know, that sort of flies in the face of things that have been said about Agenda 21 and so forth, where it at least has sounded like, according to some of the people we've spoken to, as though they're trying to push them off the coastline. So I don't know. You know, I mean that. I don't know. I'm not contradicting you. It wouldn't. Look, I think this mass die-off is wanted. Pretty sure it is, considering that, you know.
This is, from my, you know, perspective here, and I mean, my first Planet X article was published in January 2002. I started the research in 2001. Been following it over the years, and I came to understand in about 2004, 2005, what the goal is. And it is to dramatically reduce the population for a very specific purpose: control. If you look at what are we in right now, we're in a surveillance society. You know, 10-year-old girls are being groped in public by TSA workers.
Yeah,
and I mean this is humiliating. Everything we do is electronically surveilled. So we don't have any more privacy. We're owned by the state. out. If you are in a small elite minority, keep in mind there are eight people in the world with enough wealth to equal the bottom 3.5 billion put together. Just eight people. So there's a huge disparity in the distribution of wealth. And you have a small elite that are controlling things. And the folks that we see publicly are the face boys. All right. They're the straw men. The real people that are pulling the strings, that have the real power, they operate in the shadows. Yeah. Now, for them, there's a real crisis that's going to happen during this pole shift in flyby. And that is, all of their population control mechanisms are going to be utterly, totally decimated. And on one hand, humanity is going to be suffering terribly. We're going to have huge population losses. But on the other hand, we're going to be dying as free people. All right? That's a first. So once we get to the point where we're at the tail end of this tribulation, and the worst part of it, the initial cataclysms, once we're towards the end of that, that's when the elites are going to jump up from their underground bases, and that's when they're going to have an inducement for the survivors. Yeah. And they're going to say, okay, you've made it, you survived the bugs, the bombs, whatever, and we have vast warehouses, underground warehouses loaded with food, seeds, clothing, construction materials, everything you need to get started again. All right?
Yeah.
For example, Svalbard Doomsday Seed Vault up in the Arctic Circle. Go to their website, and I challenge someone publicly to find on that website a page where it says, we're doing this out of love for our fellow man, and we're going to share all of this freely.
Yeah. What is the website?
It's the Svalbard website, the Doomsday Seed Vault.
Yeah.
And so all they got to do is just go to the Svalbard Seed Vault, find that. It's up in the Arctic Circle. So the point of it is that they're going to have the inducements. And if you have 7 billion people, or say 6 billion people survive the flyby, and you have a limited amount of inducements that would, for example, be enough to make a difference in the lives of everyone on the planet for a week or maybe two, well, that's really not a huge incentive. But if the number of survivors have been dramatically whittled down to 1 in 10, now you have a really strong inducement. So what is the inducement? Well, you say, we're going to open up the bunkers. Everybody gets all of the stuff. You got to be chipped. All right. And that's when it will be the RFID chipping. And these are going to be incredibly sophisticated devices. While they're going to be telling us these are transponders, they're actually going to be transceivers. And they're going to be multi-mode, multi-frequency, and they're going to have the ability to broadcast and receive on multiple frequencies simultaneously. And they're going to be very powerful. You know, think about the Matrix. We learned that the body can generate 100 watts, to light a bulb. All right? Well, we're going to have these transceivers plucked into us. And they're not only going to know where we're at, they're going to know what our mental state of mind is. They're going to be able to use, once they get satellites back up in the sky over our heads, they'll be able to do blanket transmissions and send down neural programming to make people docile. Essentially, electronic Prozac. And then the other thing that is really going to be very disturbing for a lot of people is that they have isolated, you know, we all like to feel that we could talk to God, all right? There's like a we can, you know, connect with the other side, that we can feel that greater spiritual presence. Well, they have mapped out those frequencies. And so they'll be able to use these RFID chips, these transceivers, to put up a barrier, an electronic barrier, so we no longer literally can talk to God. And so we'll be completely programmed, Prozac. You know, we're going to be Prozac people. And that means we're going to be very controllable and easy for the elites to manage. And so the bottom line of coming through the Planet X tribulation that's coming ahead is, you know, are we going to survive as a species? Absolutely. Take that to the bank. Are we going to rebuild afterwards? Absolutely. Take that to the bank. Are we going to go to space? Absolutely. Take that to the bank.
Yes.
So then what's the question? If we're going to survive, rebuild, and go to space, what's the question? The question is how will we go to space? Are we going to go as Anunnaki stormtroopers, and that we become a proxy war species? Look at what's happening around the world today. You've got a lot of nations that use proxies to fight their battles for us, for them and for us. If you're a proxy species, then, you know, you can be sacrificed quite easily, your pawns. Or on the other hand, humanity takes this opportunity of chaos, grabs a hold of it, secures its freedom, and we have a Star Trek future. Gene Roddenberry tapped on something just very deep, something that's, you know, existential for us, is this hope of having this enlightened future. And so that's really the question of what hangs in balance. Do we go out there like Anunnaki stormtroopers, or are we going to have that Star Trek future? And the Star Trek future is really going to be, because when the elites come up with their inducements from underground, there are enough people, you're not going to get everybody to do it, but if enough people say no, all right, along the lines of Gandhi or what King taught us about peaceful non-cooperation, you know, don't go violent, don't go attacking, blood will have blood, you're going to lose. But if enough people have the courage to stand up and say no to the inducements, then that could turn the tide, and humanity could come out of this terrible cataclysm. And the worst of it will be for about 3 years, but then it's going to drag on for another 10 years approximately after that, as the Earth settles back down again, because after all of this has happened, the sun will be rising in the west and setting in the east. And so the Earth is going to have to settle. We have whole new entire land masses that'll come up from the ocean floor, and then we're going to have surface areas that are going to sink. So there's a lot of settling, there's a lot of shifting back into place, but over in time, we're going to have those blue skies again. I call that the backside. And my hope is that enough of humanity comes into enlightenment throughout this process to understand what the goal of the elites is, which is to return us to being an enslaved world, and to say, no, peaceful non-cooperation. And that's really where it comes down to. And keep one thing in mind. What is the story of Exodus about? Moses using the flyby, the last flyby of the Planet X system, which created chaos, which destroyed the control mechanisms of the Egyptians, so that he could extract the Hebrews from bondage and take them to freedom. Except in the last flyby, it was a people. In this flyby, it could be our species.
Yeah. Wow. And there are a few thoughts to think about. Amazing.
Yeah, that'll leave a. That can leave you looking at the ceiling.
Yeah, for a long time.
Yeah.
Sorry about all this coughing. Our weather situation down here in Texas is just as crazy as always. It was like freezing cold the other day. Not, it felt like it was freezing, but it wasn't. Then, warming period. Then it's like, another cooling period. Then, it warmed up. Then it went cold again. My face just went, my sinuses went, okay, that's it. You're getting a head cold. Do something about this weather, or I'll give you the flu. So, happily, it hasn't done that. So, I'm going to go with the Asian thing that, head cold, body taking opportunity to heal self. I hope that's true. But, sorry, anyway. Sorry, I have to put up with that coughing because I can't mute you when I do it. I can mute myself, but not you.
I'm getting over a flu. I understand exactly what you're going through.
Yeah, I'm getting more like Mr. Hughes every day. Oh, you're a human. Stay away. You have germs. doesn't do much for your social life. I'll tell you that.
No, it doesn't.
Yeah.
That was a guy that could live off a can of soup for 3 days.
Yeah.
And, but what was it? His favorite film was Ice Station Zebra.
Oh, perfect. Yeah, how'd that go work out after a month, I wonder? I've lost weight. Yeah, I bet you have. I can't think straight. Yeah, I bet you can't. Oh, boy. Now, why don't we just jump into the part that's going to grab people the most? I mean, this is really heady stuff, Marshall. And but everybody wants to know. There are two things that seem to be just inherent in every human being. Number one, we don't want change. And the other is, well, be that as it may, we want to survive when it comes, which we know it will, even though we don't want it. But I repeat, it will come. So what is the trick to surviving this? I mean, do you just take everything underground? I keep thinking of that Nicolas Cage movie. Isn't it remarkable to me that he's had such a career is amazing? That picture, Knowing.
Yeah, Knowing.
Yeah.
And he was saying you got to be 2 miles underground.
Was that all?
Which was interesting because that's where all the deep underground military bases are, about 2 miles underground.
Yeah. You got to be 2 miles underground.
To survive the kind of events that you see in Knowing.
Yeah.
And I believe that this will be the last survivable flyby of this system. That we're not going to have, and that, the sequence at the end of Knowing is gut-wrenching when you just see this Earth just scorch the surface of the planet.
Yeah.
And the sun just, a huge solar storm hits it and tears it up. We're not going to have that this time. That's not, in my book, Being in It for the Species, The Universe Speaks. It lays out a very specific sequence of events. All right. But we're not going to have something along the lines of what you saw in Noah. On the other hand, the next time, 3,600 years from now, when it comes around, and it could be even sooner because the orbit could become erratic, a little more erratic from this, and that's what happens with steeply inclined orbits, is that it could be what Nostradamus forecasted. All right? That in about 1,800 years from now, the planet is just scorched and becomes lifeless. That would be a Knowing sequence. That's what the elites are preparing for with their bunkers being 2 miles underground, because they've really been working on this for about a half a century. What they didn't expect when they were doing their initial planning was the phenomena of sinkholes. Yes, there's always been sinkholes in Florida and a few other places, but now we're seeing sinkholes where we've never seen them before. And you can have a really cool, deep underground military base, and if a sinkhole opens up under it, that whole base becomes compromised. And they're not going to do as well underground as we would have think. Now, we're going to know dying time is near very easily. And that is when the tarmac at Denver International Airport is littered with private jets like a bad case of the measles. Mm-hmm. And when you start seeing Gulf Streams and Citations and Lears lined up as far as the eye can see, that's it. You know, get the guest room ready. Hell's coming to visit, and it's going to be a long stay.
Yeah.
All right. Now, for those that are in planning and preparation, who's going to get through it? And I have spent years talking with people, and it's a very frustrating thing, because if you're not faced with the clear and present danger, you're seeing your own mortality, all right? Or in the case of this, it'll be when folks are standing out on the street with their family, friends, and neighbors pointing up at the sky and pooping their collective pants.
Yes.
You know, this is when you're having the conversation, fellas, you ever seen anything like that? No, George, never did, you know. And when we're having those kind of conversations, the fear that's going to be gripping people's throats is not going to be the fear of what they're seeing. It's going to be the fear that comes from knowing they're not prepared for what they're seeing.
Oh, yeah.
And they're going to understand that this is going to be a lengthy tribulation just by looking at it. Now, what I will tell you to expect is that when these things show up in the sky, they come out from behind the sun, all right, and everyone's seeing it. And we're getting all kinds of observation reports, get them all the time. There's a lot of disinformation that's being pumped out there, a lot of photoshopping. This is being done intentionally to prevent people from coming to consensus. Because if people cannot come to consensus about a commonly perceived threat, they're not going to take action on it. And remember, the goal of the elites is to keep as many people living where they're at so they'll die in place on the coastlines. And as a matter of fact, when if you were to take the denial meter, the denial meter is people who go, it's nonsense, nothing's going to happen, and I don't want to hear about it. That's the denial meter. And you in the flyover states, you know, it'll jump back and forth. You get to the coastlines, pegs it right into the red. Boom, 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 boom. Because that's where the heavy neurolinguistic programming, disinformation activities are directed. They want to keep the people on the coastlines. And that's why we're also starting to see restrictions in travel. It's, for example, in Europe, you can't cross borders now without getting stopped. And you have to have identity. They go through your luggage. It's pretty intense on the ground, just as intense on the ground now as it is going through an airport.
Yeah, it is.
And they're just acclimating us to the closures. Now, they're not going to close borders and tell people you can't move inland because of Planet X. They just would create a stampede. But if they have another threat, an ISIS, terror events, or something like that that's unrelated, then you're not going to have the stampede. So what we can expect to see is when folks are standing out in the front yard and they're pointing at this, we'll have experts on CNN and other places telling us that it's just an interesting light show. Don't worry about it. And, you know, it'll have a little bit of disruption with communications from time to time and some other things. But it's a comet with a red tail, and it's just going to fly by. And a lot of people are just going to believe that because that's what they're going to want to hear. All right? I mean, you ask these same people, do you believe your government is entirely honest with you about everything, they're all going to go, I may be dumb, but I'm not stupid. Of course they're not. And then they'll say, but with something this big, they'd have to be honest. Well, my answer to that assumption is, where is that written? I mean, is it in the Bible? Is it in the Constitution? Is it in the IRS tax code? I mean, where is it written that at some point a government that is lying to its people is all of a sudden going to have a sense of shame and conscience, and they're going to come forward and say, here's what the real deal is? And that's just a naive assumption. And so a lot of people are just going to say, well, then it's just a light show and go on, and it's going to be all the bravado and the hubris. Then we're going to start having more natural disasters, volcanic eruptions, earthquakes. Things are going to start unnerving people. They're going to start feeling things are not quite right. And that's interesting because I saw that happening this summer. I've been doing a lot of traveling to go out and do what we call a regional reconnaissance for different areas for relocation for communities. And one of the areas went up into was in the Northwest, Eastern Washington, North Idaho, Northwest, Montana. But especially in Washington State and also in Oregon. And I every chance I had during the trip, I was asking people, you know, how's the weather? Just like that. How's the weather? And there was none of the flip hubris of, well, bad year, next year is better, we'll get rains, whatever. No, they have been seeing continuing drought, longer fire seasons, more violent fire seasons. Things are getting progressively worse. And they were saying, I don't know what's wrong, but the earth is sick and it's not getting better.
Yeah.
And I don't know where this is going, and I'm troubled by that. And so are you going to hear about this in the media, which is focused on what happens on the East Coast? No. Media does, our media, corporate media, is very well controlled. So that information is not getting out, what's happening with people. We're going to have that. People are going to really sense that something's coming. But then they're going to be clinging to, it's just going to be an interesting light show, so don't worry about it. Until finally something happens and they really start to get scared. And at that point, then the talking heads come out for one last shot to say, okay, we didn't calculate this into our projections, and we apologize for that. We have revised our projections, and we believe that this is the worst of it that has already passed. All right? And what will happen is people will latch on to that, you know, like mice clinging to the straws in the midst of a flood. And that will be the last one, because after that, then things are going to get worse, and whoever's in the wrong place is just in the wrong place, and they're going to die badly.
Oh boy.
And they'll be led to their death. There will be people who are going to say, all right, I believe my lying eyes. I'm going to take action. I'm going to do something. And I believe at this point, with a very narrow window of opportunity for folks in the mainstream, when I look at what I call the 2%ers, the top 2% income bracket, I mean, I've been talking to those folks for years. They've got their bunkers. They're all in position. I mean, you'd have to really look hard to find one of them that doesn't have a personal deep underground condominium, and they will sit through the tribulation in their hot tubs watching The Sound of Music on their big screens and eating their MREs. Trust me on that one. Ask them about it, and they're going to say, it's all nonsense, nothing's going to happen, and I don't want to hear about it. Okay? They got their bunkers. I'm talking about folks in the mainstream who are buying into the nonsense that on something this big, the government would have to tell us. Whose government? We don't own our government anymore.
Right.
Okay? We don't own it. So I believe the church, the groups that are going to have the greatest ability to respond in it, what I call rapid deployment survival communities, will be faith-based organizations, particularly churches. All right. The reason why is these organizations have three significant advantages. First advantage is that they have an established chain of command, a leadership. That's not to say that they're not going to be political, everything is, but they are going to have an accepted chain of command. That's a huge advantage because this is the number one reason why egalitarian survival communities tend to fail, because they get into power grabs. And also same thing for the materially oriented preppers that are, you know, the guys that run around in the middle of the night with their AR-15s practicing for whatever. And all of these people get into power grabs. So you're not going to have the likelihood of a power grab fracturing a community and dividing loyalties. The second thing a church is going to have is, while times are good, you know, passing around the basket can take a long time to keep the bills paid. In times of disaster, these organizations have a unique advantage in terms of marshaling resources and people very quickly. They take care of things. For example, we hear about all of the money that our governments are spending around the world to help people in crisis in the third world and so forth. But the fact is, more is being done for these people by NGOs, non-governmental organizations, than all the governments put together. And, you know, folks just helping others for a noble reason, being in service to humanity. So these folks will pull together, marshal their resources. The third advantage of a church is diversity of background. You go to pray with everybody, and the person sitting in front of you could be a doctor, the one to the left of you, an engineer, a lawyer, a sanitation worker. You don't know where these people come from, their walks of life. But they're going to come from many different walks of life, and it's this diversity of skill sets that's going to be immensely valuable in creating the communities. But also, you have extended liaison networks. So you have a sanitation worker who also is a ham radio buff and knows a bunch of ham radio operators. You know, could be that that attorney that's sitting next to you is gone through the CERT program, the Citizen Emergency Response Teams, and they bring that kind of background to it. You know, other folks around you, former military, all different kinds of diversities in terms of skill sets that can come to it. So right now, those are the groups that I see are going to do the best in terms of dealing with the physical challenges of it. But more importantly, it's the spiritual and emotional challenges. Here's where the traditional preppers that I see out there, I call them bunker bunnies, the me and mine guys that are saying, I'm going to get my little, you know, 20 acres, and I'm going to have my bunker for me and my family, and everybody else can take care of themselves.
Yeah. Bunker bunnies. Well, I like that. That's
bunker bunnies.
Yeah.
And I call them bunker bunnies because they're going to become a food source. During a tribulation, you're going to have devolving human beings. You're going to have people that lose their humanity. You're going to have cannibals, but also rabies will become a problem, and people who have rabies are going to become called biters. They'll be dangerous. So you're going to have gangs, you're going to have all kinds of criminal elements. A lot of these will be swept aside by the worst of the pole shift events, namely the Great Winnowing. It's going to eradicate most of these. But you're still going to have to deal with them, and these folks are going to be in underground bunkers. Well, they typically have 1 to 2 years of supply of food. And also keep in mind that when they set those food supplies, they were using optimistic calculations. And the fact is, when people are under a huge amount of stress, they're going to eat more, going to require more calories. You go down into the bunker and, you know, fine, you spend a few days, a week, everybody's attaboy, pats on the back, aren't we clever? Then what happens is things start to get bad and all of the commercial media goes off the air. And here's where, and I think this is a very important thing, if somebody is out there right now saying, what could I do today to help me and my family get through this?
Yeah.
Get a ham radio license. I'm serious. For about $200, you can get a radio, you can get a license. Most importantly, you're going to be able to interface with a lot of people who are devoted enthusiasts, share a lot of knowledge. And the reason why I say this is because, and there's the ARRL, okay, that's the main organization, and their motto is, when all else fails, amateur radio. Think about what happens in all the floods and disasters and FEMA's communication shuts down like it did in Katrina.
Yeah.
It was amateur radio operators that saved the day.
That's right.
Amateur radio is going to be the difference between us having a Mad Max reality and some modicum of hope.
Yeah, that's
it
really
will
true.
Be the deciding technology.
And, you know, for people who are kind of rolling their eyes going, oh, man, come on. It's like you can't believe the interesting stuff that you learn when you get into those books and start studying it. Because, I mean, you have to sit down with it and start reading it. But if you do, even if you get a book on improvised antennas or stuff that you can take into the field, like you got your little backpack of radio and need to put up an antenna, what you learn about everything from stuff coming into your little Radio Shack area to get you, as in RF, to what times of day you can broadcast on certain bandwidths, it gives you a window into the electromagnetic force that surrounds us and penetrates us and binds the universe together. That'll be one thing, you know, and it's cool. It really does open a window to just a different look at the world, and you'll enjoy it. Not to mention, I mean, I got off track here a little bit, Marshall, but and they're definitely good for survival applications. But when you learn what you're doing and the kind of forces that you're playing with, it's fun. I mean, it really is. But again, it requires study.
And, you know, I got my technician license and my call sign. My fiance Jennifer not only got her technician, she went next step. She went to general so that she can do high frequency and DX around the world. Mm-hmm. And which I think is important. You know, I'm going to go for my general in February. And I think that's a good goal for everyone to do. And particularly I want to say to the ladies out there, this is not something that, yeah, it's a male-dominated hobby, but ladies, when things start to unfold, you're going to be principally in the bunker. You're going to be at the center of things. We're going to have that return to traditional roles, and the guys are going to be out foraging and hunting around for whatever they can find. Now, do you want to sit there in silence and wonder and pray and not know what's happening to your loved ones? Or do you want to be able to key a mic and say, hey, radio check, come back at me, all right? And know that they're out there, know what's going on. And the important thing for you ladies is that now is a golden opportunity to become a ham radio operator. And the reason why is that ever since the introduction of smartphones, it has caused a huge demographic imbalance. 20-somethings and 30-somethings that are typically the youth of amateur radio are not coming in as they did before because they have these gadgets that do everything and will stop doing everything after the cell phone system collapses. And that only takes about 3 days for the fuel to go out on the generators.
Yeah.
And the result is if you're going to amateur radio meetings, what you're seeing is a whole lot of silverbacks like me, all right, and older folks. And there's a dearth of this younger group, and particularly with women. And if you're a woman and you show up and you have a genuine interest, you're not going to this because your husband does it and you just want to hang out with your husband. You're doing it because you're interested. You have a dog in the fight, so to speak.
Oh, yeah.
Wow, they're going to lay out the carpet for you, and they're going to be happy to just share all kinds of knowledge, help you with all kinds of things. The information you'll get is going to be invaluable. And so for those of you ladies out there who are going, well, what could I start doing right now that would make a difference for my family during the tribulation, get a ham radio license, okay? Because this is, if you go out and you start buying cases of beans and putting them in the garage, you're going to get your head handed to you. But on the other hand, when groups of people are starting to form up to start survival communities, what you want is a skill set that's going to make you worth your weight in beans. And if you can walk in and you go, here's my call sign, and I know these people, and I know these people, and I can get equipment here and antennas there. I'm connected to all these fabulous human resources. Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah, and you know, the girls are, you know, I am not a woman, and I do not know how women think. I get an insight into it every once in a while, but I don't know. I roll with what martial arts Mesta said, which is woman completely different from man. And that's all he would ever say about it. And I went, okay, that pretty much says it all, doesn't it, Master? And it does. But I got to tell you, the women are rising. They're like, to hell with feminism. It's not helping anything. It's stupid. I mean, they really are. It's not that they're taking back their power. They never lost their power. It's like Dame Diana Rigg said. She was never a feminist. She said, well, I've always thought that women were in the stronger position. And Dame Diana is exactly right. And I mean, these women are, I mean, you give a woman who's never shot a rifle before and she'll put the bullet right in the X-ring every time, first shot. Well, I've never shot before. Well, just look down the sights and do it. The guys are standing around like, oh my gosh, she can shoot. And they'll make these dumbass jokes like, oh, men make big mistake, teach women how to shoot. It's like, what? Only if you're afraid that she's going to keep your dumb ass in line. Are you familiar with that? That's a scientific term, Marshall. Dumb ass? Kidding you. Let me ask you a question.
Really?
What is behind the name of your... what's behind the name of your website? YOWUSA. Yowza. What's up with that? I looked, but I couldn't get a clue, so...
It's Your Own World, USA.
Okay, gotcha.
And actually, Yowza started out as a travel business. And I was doing tours to Russia after Russia opened up in the 90s. That's how I wound up getting into this in the first place. Because right after Russia opened up in the early 90s, I was going every December and returning every January. Because as a tour operator, I had to go get everything set up for my summer seasons. And I would take Aeroflot and fly from San Francisco to Moscow over the pole, going, it was always at night, but on the way back was always during the day. And in the early 90s, it was the very first time I saw the Arctic. And I'm sitting there in the Aleutian 62, which is still my favorite thing to fly in. I think it's a wonderful jet. And honest to God, the Russian passenger jets are more comfortable than American.
Oh, man, their stuff is so cool looking, too.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, the lots of leg room, lots of headroom, passenger comfort. You're not spamming a can. And I'm sitting there looking through the window from horizon to horizon. And the very first time I saw the Arctic, and I was just mesmerized because I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona.
Yep.
All right. Snow was something you went somewhere else to go skiing in.
Sure.
And it was also the first time that I saw blue ice, which is very old ice. I mean, I saw blue ice was when I was in Phoenix, because you went to 7-Eleven and they put a cone with crushed ice in it and blue syrup, and that was your blue ice.
Right, yeah.
But I saw it, and the very first time I saw the Arctic, it was just, it was mesmerizing, breathtaking, unblemished, beautiful, pure, from, you know, horizon to horizon. And then over the years, as I was traveling, same time, always coming back in early February, about mid-February, and seeing the Arctic, and it just slowly deteriorated year after year. I saw it, you know, over a period of 8 years. And it was never something, well, it's seasonal highs and lows, natural variations, fluctuations. All these were ways to rationalize it. Nah, it just was, just, that's it, Harry. We're going in, feather one, you know. Mm-hmm. It was a standard, you know, slip slide into misery. And I'll never forget the last time. And I looked at it, and it really almost made me want to cry.
Yeah.
Because the Arctic looked like a busted windshield of a car in a wrecking yard.
Okay.
It was all broken up, just looked awful. And I remember that last trip, and I knew it was my last trip. And just thinking to myself, all right, so all of the paid experts who are being paid by the energy companies are telling us, no, there's no such thing as weather weirding, global, you know, global warming, whatever you want to call it these days.
Weather weirding, I think, is better than all of them.
Yeah, weather weirding is a good one. And, but I'm just going, you know, I believe my lying eyes. I'm seeing it with my own eyes.
Oh, sure.
And, you know, it's funny, you look back on episodes of your life, and having the travel business to Russia was amazing. I did things, saw things, went places that no other Americans could see, go, or do. And it just was an incredible adventure. And there were a lot of things that happened in my life, but when I look back on it, all of that to me now, I understand all of that was context. That the reason why I was doing that business was Creator wanted me to be in that airplane every February looking at what was happening to our planet.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
It really
and,
is.
And, you know, that was it. God just said, there you go. This is what I want you to see. So that you know, you understand. And I see how the media is so heavily manipulated these days. I mean, when I was working with CNN, they had a science feature department. They haven't had one for a decade. And now we don't have a media. I mean, back then, CNN was a lean, mean news machine. Now it's basically an American Pravda.
Yeah, That's absolutely what it is. And Fox isn't any better. All they do is sit around there and talk over each other. I mean, I can't take it for more than 2 minutes. It's like, does everybody have to talk at once? It's just stupid. And it's almost like, oh, we're copping to what's going on in Europe with the refugees and migrants, and we didn't see it coming. You know, we had no. It's just like, it's useless. It's nothing but a platform to sell product on. You know, I ask you what Yowza stood for, because this program is being rebroadcast, delayed, and condensed, and they may not have access to a guest media unless they become members, which, of course, we hope that you do. There are almost 450 programs in archive right now. You talk about the deal of the century. I'm not kidding you. So if you're hearing this rather than seeing it and hearing it, you know, come on. Don't be so tight. It's not only inexpensive, it's downright cheap. You know, it's interesting that you should have mentioned ice. Ladies and gentlemen, you know how you get across thin ice, don't you? Dance, dance, dance. Be right back. We'll be right back.
This is Caravan to Midnight, the John B. Wells program. Here is John B.
All right, Marshall, we have not gotten into the Planet 7X theories versus Zachariah Sitchin's work. So, in the words of the every veteran showman all through history, take it away.
All righty. And there's a tendency, because Sitchin passed away in 2010, a lot of folks want to make their bones on Sitchin's reputations by disparaging him. And what folks really need to understand is that if you hear somebody telling you that Planet X is an internet hoax, like Snopes, and it's like, I wouldn't call Snopes a reliable source, but you're going to hear that. And the fact is, the father of Planet X research in America was Percival Lowell. He was looking for Planet X. That's how they found Pluto. They thought Pluto was Planet X. And it wasn't until much, much later, 70 years, I mean, back I think in the 70s or something, they discovered Pluto's moon, Charon, and were able to determine it didn't have the mass to be Neptune's perturber or Planet X. Planet X is simply a term used in astronomy to say, we know there's an object out there by means of the way it interacts with other objects we can observe, but we haven't seen it yet. And the very first planet discovered with a telescope was Uranus. However, Neptune was not discovered with a telescope. It was discovered with mathematics. They were observing Uranus, and they could see perturbations in its orbits, little zigs, if you will.
Yeah.
And they were then able to mathematically locate Neptune. John Gall in Berlin, he took the equations and boom, dialed it right up. Perfect. Spot on. Found Neptune. Percival Lowell was looking for it, and he actually imaged it in 1915. But didn't know it. That time, he didn't perceive Pluto as a planet. Tombaugh did that with his observations. And so, but Percival Lowell is the father of Planet X research. And Neptune was discovered by the Europeans, and it was the first Planet X, and the term just came into use. So it has a long history. Now, you have, in the last century, you had Percival Lowell, and you have Velikovsky, and then Velikovsky's reputation was tainted and smeared, even though he was a good friend of Albert Einstein, and Einstein was reading his book, Worlds in Collision, at the time that he passed away, and it was on his desk. Then along comes Zachariah Sitchin. And Sitchin translated the Sumerian texts. And he did a brilliant job of it. I had the opportunity to actually know Sitchin, work with him, and to have a feel for the man and his integrity as a researcher. And this was a fellow that there was nothing speculative about him. He, you know, dotted his I's and crossed his T's. And the first time I came to know Sitchin was actually we published an article, an exclusive interview with Sitchin on Yowza.com. And this was back in 2002, as I recall. Nancy Leader of Zeta Talk and a fellow by the name of Mark Hazelwood, who had pirated a lot of Nancy Leader's work, were predicting that there would be a major catastrophic flyby of Planet X in 2003. And we didn't see, at Yowza, we didn't see any of that. So we were just calling it Zeta hysteria. And Sitchin got my telephone number from a mutual friend and reached out to me. And it was a Sunday morning. You know, it's like 8 o'clock in the morning. And, oh, God, did I have the mother of all tequila hangovers. Oh! And I'm like, you know, and the phone rings. And it's like, oh, you know, oh, do I reach for it? You know, phone keeps ringing. Okay, hello? Hello, this is Zachariah Sitchin in New York. Is this Marshall Masters? Man, hangover gone. Boy, you talk about a cinematic moment.
Oh, yeah.
And what he told me was that he was really concerned. He was, there were people that were blaming the 2003 Zeta hysteria on his book, The Lost Book of Enki, which he'd published. And his book was selling very briskly as a result of that. And he was totally opposed to it. He said, these people are completely wrong. This leader is totally wrong. And he offered to give me an exclusive interview. And we published that interview. And boy, I'll tell you, you know, I gave him editorial control over the article. And after, you know, umpteen-nine editorial review cycles, I said, that's it. We're done. We're, you know, we're going to press. And I worked with him on a few other projects afterwards and just really came to respect his work. And what I would tell your audience out there is if there's one book by Zachariah Sitchin you want to read, it's Lost Book of Enki. Because Lost Book of Enki is the autobiography of Lord Enki of the Anunnaki. Simply put, humanity came from this man's loins, all right? And Enki of the Anunnaki is the missing link, period. They took the ancient hominids. We were genetically modified to become working creatures to go out and mine gold. Because today, for our geoengineering, where we have all the jets spraying us, we use aluminum to modify our atmosphere. The Anunnaki use gold. It's not a currency thing. It's not a wealth thing. And so Sitchin was always, for me, just a man who his integrity was unimpeachable. And unfortunately, his views steps on the toes of a lot of people with very devout religious beliefs who just go, what do you mean? We weren't created by God. We were created by some guy by the name of Lord Enki, the Anunnaki, who wanted to create, you know, a slave race of gold miners, which is exactly what that story is. And then for those of you, by the way, who enjoy Game of Thrones on HBO, The Lost Book of Enki is Game of Thrones with spaceships and horny aliens. I mean, you know, it makes Farscape look like, you know, Mary Poppins.
Right.
And So his book was coming out. It was getting propelled. We did this. And I have seen over the years, the people that go out to besmirch his reputation are coming from a very strong religious point of view. And the most latest is Gil Broussard, runs Planet 7X. And I saw him in an interview on the Watchers series, which is produced by Pinlight Productions. And I appeared in several different Watchers productions. And I saw them interviewing him, and the first question was, you know, about Zachariah Sitchin. And they said, you know, everyone stands on his shoulders. And Broussard said, well, nobody vetted his work, and the attack was very general and dismissive. And so I took exception to that. I posted a video on YouTube called Planet 7X Theories versus Zachariah Sitchin's work. And I go through the whole thing about Broussard with Planet 7X. And there's no scientific basis for the term Planet 7X. As, you know, I was telling you before when we were talking about Percival Lowell and the history of the term Planet X, that there's a very, very strong history, scientific history in that term. Planet 7X is something Broussard created because he just says, well, it's seven times the size of the Earth. But he also says no one's seen it, that there have been no credible sightings or observations of Planet X or Planet 7X, but he says it's 7X, so it's a guess. So how do you create a scientific designation based on a guess? The only reason why you're going to do that is if you want to create confusion in the discussion out there. And we look at it as researchers, and we downloaded his timeline file. It's a huge PDF of 52 PDF graphics. And what I detail in the video is that he makes the claim, his tagline is using science to prove the Bible. But you can't use science to prove what he's saying because you can't follow his work. All of the text is summarized in his graphics and it's embedded in the graphics, so it can't be extracted. You can't find where he's got his research notes, his articles, you know, how he came to this. So there's no substance behind the graphics. They're presented as is. The presentation is very brilliant, very expensive. And when I look at that, it makes me wonder and ask the same question other Planet X researchers are asking us, who paid for it? Because I'm a publisher myself, and I'm a small publisher, admittedly, but I understand what goes in with graphics and doing illustrations and book covers and things like that. But also, I'm a former systems analyst in Silicon Valley. My clients included Lockheed Martin, AT&T, Oracle, Sun Microsystems, Hewlett-Packard, go on down the list. And I understand what it takes to develop a presentation like what he has. That's a team effort. If it's one man and he is an incredibly gifted graphics designer, he could do it in a year to a year and a half. And Broussard says he's a graphics designer and he makes that claim, yet when I go to research him, you can't find an online portfolio. You can't find a list of clients. You can't find anything other than in a couple of social media sites, he makes the claim to be a graphics designer. And then what he says is that he was able to get that much work out because he had the help of family and some interns in the college. Well, I've been working with those kind of graphics that he has in his timeline for many years. No ham and egg is going to do that. Those graphics are of professional quality. I'm talking about the big four publishers. who are going after, for example, home study and for library market. And because these are very, very intricate, very integrated graphics, very elegant. And something like that takes a team effort and an awful lot of money, and you have to have professional talent, someone who is very well trained on how to use a tool like Photoshop, not someone who bought it and played around with it over the weekend, but somebody who really knows how to do something with it. And there's no provenance, there's no substance to his claims that he's a graphics designer. He can't prove how these things are done. And so he doesn't provide the research to back it up. He's very popular because he's talking to the Christian audience. All right. And, you know, I posted this video and I just go through and I'm asking logical questions based on statements he made in an interview in the Watcher series. And, you know, I don't have public voting where people can see the vote counts, but, you know, it's more than 2-1 in my favor in terms of people seeing how I'm presenting and questioning the work that he's doing. And it makes me wonder, you know, earlier I told you you're going to have the government coming out with talking heads and saying, don't worry, it's just a red-tailed comet in the sky. All right. Well, what is media going to do, the controlled media? Now, people are going to say, well, you know, can we really trust the government? So what are they going to do? Parade out a whole bunch of conspiracy theorists to challenge what the government position is. But what if that's already been thought of by the elites and these alleged conspiracy theorists that they're going to parade out are going to come out with all kinds of crazy theories, but in the final analysis, you know, it's like talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll to a priest. You're going to come back to the papal line. All right?
Yeah.
And, you know, that's, I look at that, and those are the concerns that I have, that I'm not necessarily saying that that's what he's going to do, but this kind of work could be used to lead people into making a fatal mistake, which is not doing something. All right? I mean, for me, if you want one simple difference between me and Broussard, my message when it comes to planning and preparation is, why in the hell are you not doing it if you're not doing it right now? Period. Get off your butt. Do and just do it. That's me.
Yeah.
Broussard, well, you know, kind of maybe, maybe not. If you want to do it, why not? Of course. But he doesn't have a real clear position on you got to take action and do something. And
well, you know, but so many people don't, Marshall.
Really disturbs me. Huh?
I'm sorry. That's what you say. That's what disturbs you. And it does, because it's but you know, I wonder if there's anything that can be done other than go through some motions, because we really don't know what the actual form will be. We don't know what the effect is going to be, what form the future will take, and what psychological effect it will have on people who behold it. As far as mainstream media is concerned, they are a total non-entity now, and I think they should just be discounted. In fact, I think in their present form, I'm pretty sure they're not going to like this, but, you know, forget about it. They should be relegated to the dustbin of history, the dustbin, not the archives. It's useless.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, they're less than useless. I mean, they're going to be used to, people are going to turn to Fox and CNN and MSNBC, which are basically demographic markets. They're
absolutely
not competing news entities.
No. No, well, it makes no difference whether it's the left or the right. It's like they're reading from the same script. I've said this many
right
times. Sometimes the news reports, I mean, the words are the same. So where'd they get, who printed the sheet off?
Yeah, they're just, you know, tweaking the message for their demographic. And so, and I agree with you completely. Maybe we'll see them doing some last-ditch effort to redeem themselves. But it really is going to boil down to people who are going to be prepared to think for themselves and to take action. And, you know, it's one of the things that I've done with my fiance, Jennifer. We started a non-denominational teaching church because, as I explained before, churches are going to have the best ability to respond quickly in a rapid deployment in a narrow window of time. So by having a non-denominational teaching church, what we really want to do is it's an outreach working with these other churches and helping them to help themselves and to save their, you know, save lives. And when I first came into this research, John, I was born hard geek, you know, yeah. Spock wannabe, live long and prosper, logic is tweeting bird. That was me. And if you ask me about any of this stuff, I say, oh man, I don't need to hear about the princess who shoots the golden arrow into the sky and kills the hoochie coochie monster.
Right.
I was real, real hard and cynic. And what I came to find was that there's no way to find hope in that mind view. That if you come at it purely from a standpoint of beans, bullets, and bunkers, you're ultimately going to fail because we're looking at a period of, you know, anywhere from 7 to 12 years of hardship. After that, we will have blue skies once again, and we will eventually have a beautiful planet again. So, you know, it's not this total Mad Max reality. But getting there is going to, it's going to be a lot of hardship. And what's going to pull people through is patience and fortitude, and particularly three things. One, self-sufficiency knowledge. Two, hope for the future. And three, knowing you are not alone. If people have those three things, all right, that's going to give them a reason to get up in the morning and take on one more day. And it's going to be one day after another of difficult, if not impossible, decisions.
Oh, yes.
But we can pull together. And we, in the hardship, you know, when things are at their worst, we really are at our best. And so, yeah, there's a dark cloud coming. I've been talking about it for years. Wake up and smell the coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing is, my focus right now is on that silver lining.
Yeah, well, you know, man, that box of MREs and the deer rifle in the tent. I was just thinking, and people have been hearing me cough throughout this program. Again, I apologize for that, but I'm trying to make it as quiet as possible, and it ain't really happening. But ain't. There's a word I like to use every once in a while just to keep it alive. But you know, not because it's good English. But the thing is when you get something like one of those, just a head cold. Your sinuses are throbbing. You're going, oh my gosh, you know, and your muscles are aching, your thighs and your backside, your calves, and you're just all of this. And you think all your familiar conveniences, shall we call them, are really necessities like heating and air conditioning, running water, food availability, medical help, all those things. Suddenly all those things are gone, and now you're put in a position of having to move with 5 or 6 or 10 or 20 other people and not be a drag on them, and you don't feel very good. I mean, we think we're just going to take on this poop storm with a smile and a determined attitude, and we're going to just feel great and we'll be in tip-top shape. But when other things like, you know, the thorn in your finger that's now getting infected, and you don't have any antibiotics. And before long, if this isn't stopped, it's going to turn into gangrene. Someone's going to have to take the campsite hatchet to it. Then there's the tetanus component. It's like there is no way to be ready for everything and go it on your own. You can't do it.
You can't do it. You're absolutely right. That's the reason why my philosophy is that surviving this is not about holding on to things. It's about holding on to each other.
Yes.
And, you know, right now I'm working on my next book, which is going to be titled Surviving the Planet X Tribulation, The First Solution for the Last to Know. And I'm taking it from a viewpoint, I'm talking to the leader of a church. Well, all of a sudden, I got to get my flock to safety. And walking that person through all the decision processes, things that you can glom onto, things that you can do, doable things, rapidly doable things. And for me, the three most important survival skills, all right, are invention, insight, and initiative, all right? And so we think about, oh, my gosh, our technology is going to disappear. I'm seeing a renaissance. I mean, stop and think about it. Right now, we have so many wonderful people who are inventing holistic cures for cancer, free energy devices and so forth. And what happens to them? You know, they commit suicide by stabbing themselves in the back 17 times.
Right.
All right. What happens when all of a sudden all of these elitist control mechanisms and the government goons that serve their agenda are no longer busting into civilian laboratories, you know, and just taking everything in sight and arresting honest, hardworking people on absolute nonsense charges and then grinding their lives to pieces through a legal system that's designed to grind people's lives to pieces for the benefit of the elites who hold the controlling levers. All of that's gone. And then all of a sudden, we have Nikola Teslas popping up everywhere. And they're finding solutions, simple solutions that make a real difference for people's lives. Then it's about getting that knowledge out there, sharing it with others. Self-sufficiency knowledge. And with self-sufficiency knowledge, people will have hope for the future. Sitting like a bunker bunny, and you're down in your bunker, and every time you hear one of the motors in your equipment room start to rattle about, getting unnerved, or all of a sudden everyone starts to think they hear the sound of picks and shovels overhead, all right? Instead of living like that, you know, you're solving problems, you're pulling together, you're celebrating life. There's a noble purpose to what you're doing. And that's the vision that I'm trying to share with people, is that, okay, let's have that noble vision. Let's say we're going to go through this, and the goal of this is that humanity is free and has that Star Trek future. And how do you become a part of that? Well, you ask God. You've got to get on your knees and you got to pray. And you got to find that connection, just you and Creator, one-on-one. How can I serve the plan? How can I move the ball forward? How can I help this species become something more than it has been before? To get through this for a purpose, instead of us wind up becoming, you know, proxy soldiers for bizarre, you know, gold-lusting aliens or whatever dark future the elites have in store for us. And, you know, if you want to see what that future looks like, you go to the movies.
Yeah.
Hunger Games. That's the world that the elites are planning for us to, when we come out of this, that's what they want us to have.
Well, we've had about enough of that stuff, though. You know, Marshall, I think we've had about enough of that, just like this bunch of the UN. In my opinion, the UN needs to be dismantled and destroyed. And they can reconvene somewhere else to get together and discuss potential problems. But as far as this bunch of bastards, if you'll excuse the expression, deciding what our fate will be and how we shall live and whether we'll be able to protect ourselves or arm ourselves or do any of these things, I say to hell with these people. They've had their run, these elites and their families that carry on their heinous crimes against humanity, the chief lubricant being, of course, money. It's over with. These people are not going to make it. They're really not. People have had just about enough of this. But what we need to do, and it sounds a little draconian, but the savages who are trying to destroy Europe right now, they need to be neutralized. And the elites who are orchestrating it need to be neutralized and leave the ones in the middle to sort it out. Because we're the ones who always have to sort it out. We're the ones who have to clean up their messes. We're the ones who have to bleed because of the problems they create. And I don't know, Marshall, I just think we're just at the point where it's about to be, gloves are coming off, and we're just going to stomp you into a greasy spot on the pavement. It's over with. You know, we're all finished talking. You're coming down out of that treehouse, and we're going to tear your castle down, and you with it.
History is going to do that for us. The Planet X flyby is going to completely fracture their control systems.
Good.
Let me share with you something, because it was back about in 2005 that I came to the realization of what the real purpose of all this is, which is to depopulate the planet, get us down to very small, manageable numbers. If they want a large population on the earth after that, you know what? Just give us a case of Ripple wine and some Viagra. We could work wonders. All right. But I was just so depressed realizing that. And there was this young lady, she was in her early 40s. And she was a channeler and worked with her. And we were at a very scientific method to how we did it. And we would vet all of the entities that we connected with. And they all vetted. We would ask them to give us a weather event 6 to 12 months out. And they would give us a weather event. And sure enough, it would always happen. It would be a typhoon in one place or a hurricane in another, something like that. But I was really down in the dumps one day, and I called her and was talking about this. And she said, well, let me just see, you know, throw it out there and see who comes in. And so she did. And next thing I know, I'm talking to this guide, Serapis Bey. Funny thing is, you can find him on Wikipedia. Serapis Bey was an ancient priest in Egypt, temple priest. And this is his thing. It's his bag. And so here was what Serapis Bey told me that day, and it was a pivotal turning point in my life that gave me hope. And Serapis Bey said, Marshall, humanity is a big book, and the book is far from being finished. It has many blank pages, as many chapters. This chapter belongs to the elites. You're not going to take it away from them. So don't bother trying. Don't bother complaining. Just don't try. It's theirs, and it's theirs permanently. But this chapter, which they own completely, like all chapters in all books, as do all books, eventually comes to an end. And this chapter is in its last pages. The next chapter does not belong to them. They know that. And they know that the only way they can transfer their control of your species from this chapter to the next chapter, because the next chapter does belong to humanity, not to them. But the only way they can get control of that is by bluffing. Call the bluff. Yep. They will fail.
That's good stuff. Yeah.
And so that's, you know, that's what it's all about. Knowledge Mountain, you know, that I formed with Jennifer, Knowledge Mountain Church of Perpetual Genesis, non-denominational. You know, whatever your core faith is, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. We're just a fill-in-the-gaps kind of a group. And, but again, we're doing it as a church because this is where we feel that we can work with other churches, and we believe that churches in general are going to be the bodies that are going to be most capable of forming survival communities that can endure and last, because they're going to be based in faith. They're going to be based in a love of Creator, not going to be a bunch of wackos sitting there with MREs arguing about who's going to be the boss this week.
Oh, man.
All right.
You have thought this through. I know you have.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the final analysis, if just enough people call the bluff, enough people say no. And keep in mind, that's not going to be easy, because with the elites always comes the carrot, then comes the stick. Mm-hmm. So you're not saying no to the carrot, you're saying no to the stick. But if enough people are willing to say no to the stick, then what they have will unravel. Keep in mind that during the American Revolution, only 70% of the colonists participated and stood up and took the risk to be part of the revolution. The
I didn't know the percentage was that high.
On the sidelines or helped the British.
I didn't know the percentage was that high. Did you say 7 or 70?
70% just set aside. 30% were involved in the revolution.
Yeah.
And 70% were just, you know, sitting on the sidelines or working with the British. So in the case of our own revolution, it only took 30% of the population to form a sufficient critical mass to free the country. And I think that's, you know, a good measure. So, yeah, I mean, we just have to focus on, you know, getting enough of a critical mass of people who are going to make that difference. That's where it's at.
I think we're gathering more of them every day. And I would submit to you and to the world that there, I think there are more people interested in perhaps giving their lives in the cause of freedom than those who are willing to lose their lives in furtherance of enslavement.
Yeah.
Maybe they ought to think that over.
I think that's the case, you know. I think people do. We will sacrifice for our fellow men. You know, we often hear the stories about a soldier who throws himself on a grenade to save his friends. All right? We're programmed to do this. It's within us. We're capable of doing it. You know, the key to it, the key to us prevailing, and here I have to speak as a guy who was a born hard geek for the vast majority of his life. You know, I was a Spock wannabe. Logic is tweeting bird. I didn't want to have that. And still the same. What's going to make the difference is walking humbly with your God.
Yeah.
That's what's going to make the difference.
Yep. If he sees fit to rewrite your DNA and make you radiation proof, trust me, that'll happen. I'm saying if.
You know, you got to have, for me, it's really a case of no longer worrying about, oh my God, do I have enough of this? Do I have enough of that? Do I have enough of the other thing? Because bottom line, we're looking at something that's going to last for so many years. I don't care how much you stockpile, it's not going to last. And at some point, you're going to have to be self-reliant. So you really, instead of this mentality of I'm going to have full preparedness for the full duration or whatever, no, all you're doing is creating a buffer. That's it.
Yeah.
All you're creating is a buffer. So you can get to creating better renewable solutions. But it's pulling together with people and having faith in Creator, believing in our own nobility, in our inventiveness, in our initiative, in our ability to have insight into things and change. And so I go, you know, on a basis of kind of like for me, I guess the best way to say it is I see my life in a long, dark tunnel with many twists and turns. And it's pitch black. I know at the end of the tunnel, there's blue sky and beautiful light. And getting there is a long trip with twists and turns. And yeah. When you walk with Creator, what happens is Creator lights a candle in the darkness. You walk to that candle. And then you wait. And sure enough, Creator will light another candle. And you walk to that candle. And then so on and so on and so on. And you walk from candle to candle. That's faith. And so that's, you know, how I have changed in my view of all of this. And there are a lot of people out there, John, who have been in awareness. They tend to be 45 to 65 years of age as a rule. There's a lot more younger ones coming in now. And I'd say at least 80% of the time when I'm asking them, they're telling me that they've been in awareness since they were children. And they've had lives to prepare for what is coming. These people are really treated badly. They're mocked and humiliated by friends and families and spouses. You know, it's, I don't want to hear about it. It's nonsense. Shut up. They get ostracized. You know, fastest way to fall off a Christmas card list is talk about Planet X.
Right.
And, you know, you get the feeling, boy, now I know how Noah felt. All right. And the biggest frustration for these folks, because they endure it, all of the abuse, is they go, I have all this knowledge. I have all this awareness, but I don't have the wherewithal to go buy beans, bullets, and bunkers. And they're frustrated. And what I try and tell them is, well, Creator didn't give you the awareness so that you would go out and buy beans, bullets, and bunkers. Your mission as someone in awareness is to be a teacher, a mentor, someone to bring a hopeful message. Because the folks that are going to be surviving are going to be coming to awareness right up against the wall. What you've had the benefit of years and in many cases decades to assimilate for these people is going to become something immensely difficult, immensely trying. And it's going to be hard for them to keep their moral compass, to maintain their nobility as humans, and to go at this with an enlightened view of creating a better future for humanity. This is where your lifetime of preparation and awareness is your advantage. This is what you bring. This is, you've had the chance to process all of this. And so you're going to be able to help those who are processing. And that's really what the mission of these folks are. And so there's a much broader picture that I see going on. And it's, on one hand, has its horrific elements, and on the other, very noble, very inspiring elements. It's a vast panorama of a turning point in the history of our species.
Yeah, you made a couple of references to Star Trek. But maybe a reference to Star Wars wouldn't be bad. We must all become that Obi-Wan Kenobi character.
There you go.
A little bit of Obi-Wan and everybody. I think that'd make for a pretty good outcome. I got to tell you, Mr. Masters, You know who Pat McGowan is? Patrick McGowan. Remember he did the Prisoner series back in the 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah, remember that? Well, we do a little thing sometimes. Not often, but sometimes. But it goes something like this. You, Marshall Masters, in the manner of McGowan, truly have gloriously illustrated and vindicated the right of the individual to be individual. And I hereby induct you into the Order of the Ark Knights, and henceforth we address you as Sir Marshall. And this assembly rises to you, sir. That's it.
Thank you.
Short and sweet, hey. It means a lot to us that we have the benefit of your lifetime of searching and coming up with some answers that a man of conscience, a woman of conscience can live with. And I perceive that you give all of the credit, sometimes known as glory, to your creator, sometimes known as God Almighty.
I work for Big G.
Me too. Well, may he bless you. May he continue to bless you. And may you return soon and in safety back to Caravan to Midnight at some near point in future.
Look forward to it, John.
So do I. Thanks, Marshall.
Thank you, sir.
Marshall Masters, everybody. Now, look here now. That the Yowza is the your own world, USA. Y-O-W-U-S-A. Notice I did not say W. It's a W. No, it's a W. Yowusa.com and KnowledgeMountain.org. All right. Well, it's coming, isn't it? But it'll be exciting. It'll be invigorating. It'll be challenging. I can't think of anything that will make one feel more alive. Well, there's a couple of things. One of them is a close brush with death. That'll do it. And a deep contemplation of eternity. We're all writing our histories right now. Let's write them as closely to, as we can, to the way we wish them to be written. Start now, because today is already yesterday. Until we meet again, hopefully sooner than later, exercise caution in your daily affairs, eyes up always, make ready for what's to come. God bless. Be seeing you.